the decisions would be made as to during which interim the various exemptions would be dealt with, okay? Then as soon as the election took place, and assuming that it passed, notification would become automatic because that, you know, that the groundwork would already be laid. The decision would already be made which categories can be dealt with in 80 and 82 and 84 and 86. And as of November 78, you could notify folks that in the next interim, following the 79 session, certain categories of exemptions would be dealt with. And that would be considerable notification. I think it would be adequate notification.
That'd be much longer notification than you didn't want to get the notification right now.
The problem, of course, with trying to do substantive work in this first interim is that it's kind of putting the cart before the horse because the folks would not have spoken yet as to whether they wanted us to do this. I don't know.
But do you still think that
We would still have four full interims to do the work.
Whatever happens, you would want in this trailer bill, though, that there would be a minimum of notification time.
Oh, yes. I think that's fine.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Bill Fritz from Common Cause. The only concern I have in trying, and I tend to agree with Representative Monroe, the only concern I have now in trying to design something, and as we talked about it last time with the representative from the Legislative Council, is that this, of course, this legislature cannot mandate or cannot hold the 79 or 81 legislature to a particular, to review these exemptions.
That's right.
To say. However, the interim following this session could in fact submit an interim bill saying that during the 79 interim these will be reviewed. And not only would they review that, but then they would submit another bill to the I guess the 81 session that would say during the 81-82 interim these are I don't know if, considering the current the structure of ACR 7 and everything else, I don't know how else it can be done except one interim or one legislature mandating for that biennium.
I think that's correct.
I guess a bill the trailer bill could in fact set out what this legislature would like to see, suggested groupings.
It could
or it could wait until the 79 legislature when they make the decision. But if it went that way, then there would be, if I envision, if the review starts in January of the even year, thus giving it 11 or 12 months to review, that you would have there a minimum of 6 months' notice from the end of the session till January to all those affected. I don't know if that is viewed as sufficient time.
That's something I think we have to look at just on the timing of it. I think you probably could list it in general categories in the trailer bill here, the ones that we're going to be looked at. I don't think that would hold, wouldn't it? If we were to list it in the trailer bill statute, the various groups that would be considered to be looked at under this particular, if HJR 7 passes.
Okay. Gary Carlson, AY. I just got a question about the intent of the of this committee as to the scope of HGR 7. It seems to me if the wording could be interpreted very broadly. In other words, we have some kind of a property which is exempt from annual ad valorem taxation, but in lieu thereof, there is another kind of tax enacted on that property. I guess an example probably is 14 yield law. Another example, I guess, that concerns me about the scope of this is who the burden falls on after the ending date here of December 31, 1987. I assume it falls on the taxpayer. Prove that whose property is taxed at no less than full market value. There are several ways of valuing property, just one of which is the evidence in the marketplace. And I guess the concern I have then is what happens on January 1, 1988, when property that has, for example, been assessed on the basis of an income capitalization approach or some different approach than market value or different method at arriving at market value. Does it take a simple challenge from any individual to trigger some kind of review by the court? I don't know if I'm making myself clear, but it just seems to me that there are some gray areas here that we're talking about that experts can disagree as to whether or not a particular approach is being applied actually results in market value assessment and taxation.
Mr. Chairman? Yes, as I understand it, the courts give more weight to actual sales that have occurred in the marketplace than they do to any with using an income approach or...
What if you don't have any, like in industrial property? What if you don't have any at all? In a certain class of industrial property?
You're in the same position, essentially, as that you are now, and that is that it's a question of fact, if you appeal it, and that you bring in all your appraisers and all your witnesses, and the Department of Revenue or the county assessor brings in all his appraisers and all his evidence to support it. And then that's the problem now, isn't it, in many classes of property,
Yes, it is, but it seems to me this throws a new kink in the current situation as to those properties that are valued on some basis other than very clear market evidence, as in the case with single-family residences.
Gary, I think that's a substantive matter that's going, it's a very real problem, but I think the substantive matter that's going to have to be taken up whenever that particular class of property is reviewed during this 10-year period.
Okay, I guess one of my questions is what triggers it being reviewed?
That's what we're to determine.
I'm not saying what, laying out the time frame which you review these things. I'm saying looking at the language in the first part of lines 5 through 8 of this measure, HDR 7, are you, for example, going to say that, are you, for example, going to include a review of how all industrial property is currently assessed?
Are you telling us that it's because not, it's not
because
market
it's,
value?
No, I'm saying because it's not currently done on the basis of market transactions.
I think this is the proper topic for discussion when that particular classification of property comes up for review.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask Ted something? My understanding of the situation is currently industrial property is valued under, they put market value on it. They simply don't have any sales, and so they use what information they have, or their sales are limited.
I think this is muddying the waters because there are three approaches to evaluation of market value, and that we're talking about appraisal processes, which is not what the legislature is dealing with here. The legislature is saying any time that you can't, you're not supposed to find market value for property, there's an exemption involved. And I don't think it's that unclear. The statute
there's just three approaches to finding that market.
Right. And industrial property, you don't use one approach, or don't sell industrial property every day, but it's still assessed at market value. I think have you come up here and...
Okay, so what you're telling me then is that the market value of farmland, which is currently found on the basis of a capitalization of an income flow and land rents, is not going to be reviewed.
Oh, of course, because the statutes very clearly say you don't use market data approach in certain cases. Now, where they're using market data approach, you wouldn't review it.
Where farm use is the highest and best use, and the procedure is to use a capitalization of income flow, and you're saying it will not be reviewed by this legislature.
It will be reviewed because you're using capitalization method.
Well, you just told me that there are three methods of determining market value, and this says if it's not valued at market value, it will be reviewed.
That's the legislature said that in certain cases you won't use one of those methods because that's too high.
Before we start arguing over exemptions, the main thing is adequate time, if those particular areas were to come under review process, what is the adequate amount of time needed to get data together to challenge one of these three methods in which and get the exemption reinstituted again if it's necessary? Can you collect data?
Oh, yeah, okay, that's no problem. I'm not talking about the time. I'm talking about the philosophy of the measure. And I guess what the answer you're giving me is that the intent is that the entire issue is wide open. The issue of how you find market value for any kind of property is wide open. That's what I really
want to say. Yeah, what I see is not the fact that you may be losing an exemption, but I see the fact that you may be reinstituting an exemption even under different ground rules.
Okay, in some cases where there's not a clear exemption, but where there's something other than market sales used as a measure of market value, you're saying will be reviewed, that process will be reviewed. And that's what I'm trying to determine if that's your intent.
I think that's the general intent I see off of the entire process in which the exemption was given in the first place will come into review.
An exemption should be, do we define exemption?
Mr. Chairman, just to get back on track, if we might. Might I suggest to reinforce Representative Monroe's thinking that the process be this, that in the event that the voters approve the ballot measure in 1977, that the bill that we're designing instructs the Interim Committee on Revenue, the Joint Interim Committee on Revenue, develop a sequential plan of review that will be submitted to the 1979 Legislative Assembly for their approval, so that then that will set in or trigger the process of reviewing all of these. I think that's
a sequential plan for the entire 10-year period, or sequential plan just for the
following year? Disagreeing with Bill, I think it should be for the entire 10-year period. And the problem that I have with not doing it in block is in recognizing that any other legislative assembly can come back and change it, that once it is, in fact, established, they're more likely to go through with the process over that 10-year period than they are if you say, we'll approve phase one now, 2 years come back and let the next assembly approve phase two, because what bothers me is that you may come back and then you get into political arguments about phase two, and if it's all spelled out, laid out, I think it's more likely to
All right, what you're saying then is we want to make sure that nobody has the uncertainty that they're not going to be reviewed in time certain.
That's correct.
Bill, is that what you were saying?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, again, Bill Fritz, Common Cause. I'd agree with Representative Grinnell. My only question was whether or not it could be defined, and obviously it can. However, if the legislature lays out the guidelines, and he put them down either in the 77 or the 79 legislature, which ones will come up in sequence or groupings. It would be difficult at that point, if that's made logically, to then change that around and get involved in some political decisions changing around. It'd be probably better to lay them all out now or during the interim following the session.
And my argument for doing it in the interim is that we really can't take firm action until after the voters have acted, first of all. Secondly, it looks to me like it's going to be a big job if we do it right to really look at the whole exemption picture. It's going to take a lot of time, and we're pressed for time now. And yet we've got this interim that we're looking at when we're going to have that time that could be spent. I think that the interim committee could do a more thorough, more complete job. And so I think it just makes sense, since we have that available interim before the vote is taken, to use that time rather than to try to hash through something in an emergency kind of situation now that might not be the most thorough job possible.
Well, I agree that the interim period is the right time. I think those of us who served on interim committees may have some question as to the thoroughness that will get done during that time.
I'm a naive freshman.
At any rate, that's probably the proper place for it, that's for sure. Yes,
Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I have to agree with Representative Grinnell on getting it all laid out. If you agree with the concept of the bill, then everybody should be shown exactly where it's going to fall. but you won't get the arguments that you're getting from some groups who were called in this time saying, don't pick on us, we'll stick on everybody else at the same time. You've laid it out, you've eliminated at least some criticism that's going to come your way. And also you're eliminating the political pressure, which Bill has brought up for doing it on a piecemeal basis. I don't want to have to fight every year or every biennium to try to keep myself off the list this year or keep myself on the list, whatever it may be.
We don't want to fight you. We don't want to fight to get you back on.
Unless
we happen to have the vote that day.
That's the only problem with saying that 6 thing is not being able to count votes very well.
The other question is if there is a major area that is considered in half in legislative session, does that take that group off the hook for a 10-year period?
This session? 77?
Well, what you would be doing
absolutely
is
not.
Well, this session.
Yes, there's a couple of things up that are very well affected. What you're saying is that we may make those major changes this time, and does that mean that they will be reviewed again within this 10-year period?
I would say so, because I don't see how we, you know, the vote, it seems to me when the vote is taken, when the folks out there speak in November of 78, that's what institutes the plan, and it's from then on.
We could institute automatic review date, like, Bill calls on our own this session, so that it would be taken care of.
It's possible. You might check that out, the legal arm, see on anything that happens in this particular session, if there's any way to give them the time certain under this review if HJR 7 is passed. Check out the legal ramifications.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
I'd like to ask Ted just a couple questions. I noticed the definition, I think the point that was raised by Mr. Carlson, the definition of an exemption under the terms of the resolution. And I want to make certain that we are doing what I think we're doing in terms of making certain that when we mean a exemption, we mean any attempt to get at a different value than market value, okay? Because I know the statute says, like, in different places in the statute, it says like this: the market value of X will be determined by taking 30% times whatever the sales are in the marketplace, or the market value of X will be taken by using a capitalization rate based on dot, 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 dot. Okay, and here on line 11, it says a reduction in the valuation of property from full market value. Full market value, I wonder if there's a definition in the law that's independent of all those statutes that say the market value of such and such will be determined by taking dot, dot, dot. In other words, by actually making a modification to what the market value really is.
Well, the statute basically says true cash value, and defines true cash value as in the terms of market value. But in your situation, I don't think you'll find a statute that does that. It says you take the true cash value. The true cash value is 30% of something.
Is that what it says? You sure?
The median harvest value is 30%. You take 30% of the median harvest value.
Okay. Oh, market value should be determined by
taking 30% of the market value. You're saying, is there a place where
it says? I think there's places where it says market value shall be the market value shall be determined by
the true cash value.
Oh,
the
true cash value.
Oh,
I see.
True cash value
will be taken by, or will be derived by taking the market value.
Usually, notwithstanding ORS 308-232, which says true cash value is the full market value. So notwithstanding that, true cash value shall be something else.
Do we need a more definitive term on full market value?
If I understand what Gary's saying, and Gary is asking, if I understand what he's saying, and if it makes any sense at all to me, he's saying that, are we going to review, leave it open for review every time the assessor fails to find market value? Is that what you're saying?
No.
Because otherwise, like in line 6, if you said special consideration given property by statute or constitution. Now, that is too hard to identify when the statute gives special consideration. That's all you're really talking about. But if you're talking about whether or not a particular method of determining market value, like capitalization, is going to be reviewed, that is not given. If that is given by, if the statute throws out some methods, then there is special consideration given. But ordinarily, if all three are available and you only have one to use because you only have debt on that one, that's not special consideration by statute. So
what,
tighten it up by saying special consideration by statute or constitution or something like that.
Chuck Williams, AOI. Would this bill bring about a review of, say, industrial property? An industrial property is valued at market. That market is determined by sales, which are very few, replacement cost, I think is the term they use,
an
income approach. Okay. The definition is market, not a reduction of market, it is market. There are these three methods, of which some of them cannot be used just for the sheer fact that you don't sell a Boise Cascade plant.
The way the bill is currently written, it would not affect industrial property.
Right. We would not
review
this.
That's
the way I understood it, too.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make sure that's what we were.
This is a question Gary had.
Yeah. We're not going into a review of assessment policies and procedures and methods. We are going and looking at
exemptions
reductions below market.
That's right. Only when the statute mandates something other than true cash value, some deviation from true cash value.
That would be a reduction from the full market.
The only thing I see right now that industrial property would probably be looked at would be the pollution control facility, which would be given for the purpose of trying to get pollution equipment going. That's the only thing on industrial property.
And since this has an outlaw,
some industrial parks that are, for example, municipal.
The more difficult area is the farmland assessment reductions and the forest land reductions based on the fact that in some cases the lack of sales to really determine what the true market value is.
Well, this is the distinction we were looking at, is making sure we're talking about reductions in market instead of methods of deriving market.
With the wrong price. Or the wrong price.
The wrong place, I think. Not wrong price.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, George Miller, Department of Revenue. If you're looking for categories to review during these interim periods, I think the publication that was put out when?
1974.
Put out December 74 relating to exemptions might be a good place to start. There are some major headings in there relating to property taxation that breaks them down into at least three good categories and throws in a fourth of other exemptions, which would tie right in with your interim period. Breaks it down into: one is exemptions granted to preserve the environment, two is exemptions granted to encourage or preserve business, three exemptions granted to preserve social welfare, and other exemptions. They're pretty broad categories, but they're the place to start.
A technical question, does an exemption also include the amount of money that may be received as a relief to such things as taxation? Such things as homeowners and renters relief. Is that an exemption as you see it, technically?
Property still is a phrase in the tax that's full true cash value.
Somebody else is paying
the tax. The deferral program wouldn't come in as an exemption because property still at market.
Ted.
Somebody's paying the tax besides the owner.
I missed your earlier meeting. I'm not sure if this was addressed at all, but to what extent has thought been given in setting up the mechanics of it to the difficulties that might arise in terms of the capacity of some of these entities to secure financing while the period is in question? Taking hospitals as one example, in pursuing the mechanics, it would seem to me that we should address the fact that there is going to be a period of uncertainty in here, which may make it difficult for a hospital, say, that normally goes out and gets 25-year financing, to achieve that financing without having some interest rate penalty, which on the part of the lender would address itself to the fact that there is uncertainty in its tax base. Has that been addressed?
It really hasn't, Ted. We touched on it lightly when we started to figure out if we could actually set up a schedule, and then we determined that what we would do is follow really Representative Monroe's suggestion that the how we had dealt with this would be really done in the interim period at the time that the special committee had been set up, or a committee of the revenue, of which would be a joint House and Senate committee. And that the uncertainty aspect was a key factor, but we really didn't know how to deal with it. We would try to probably get those organizations that were living with uncertainty taken care of first.
Yeah, that's one of the key factors that we're going to want to look at, and that's one of the reasons why we need more time, because there are a lot of things, a lot of factors that we want to look at when determining which exemptions should be dealt with first. Those kind that you're talking about, I would say, should get high priority for treatment in that very first review interim, the 79-80, I guess it would be interim.
But doesn't that uncertainty start with the day that HCR 7 is passed?
That's November 78.
Right. That's right, and yeah. I look at it as possibly one of the key points that the public will feel may be against the HCR 7 because of that reason.
Because if a farm, it could presumably relate to farms.
Very much
to
farms.
Woodlots, forest hospitals, and the industrial aspect of pollution control bonds. Not major aspect there, but nonetheless,
they affect finances.
But there will be nothing in HJR 7 to prevent the 79 session of the legislature from reviewing some of those things specifically on the basis of bills that are submitted. Is that right?
That's correct.
Even though the interim committee may have determined that that would be dealt with in the 79-80 interim, there'd be nothing to prevent. We couldn't prevent if we wanted to. The 79 legislature from looking at some of those.
And actually accepting a bill right away.
Accepting a bill, right.
Chuck Williams, AOI. Is there some way to put in this trailer bill a requirement for an economic impact statement similar to the fiscal impact statement that they put out on state expenditures, and a revenue impact statement like they put out on revenue measures currently by, let's say, revenue office here, that there is an economic impact statement prepared during the review of this thing?
That will be part of the preparation for the review.
Right.
At the time that
you've
been announced.
We can tell how much money the counties can receive through it in, and the effect on the tax rate, and build up all these good things. But looking at, we've been currently watching a bill going to the Senate and watching some of the things that have happened on it on a simple exemption, and there's more work done on the fiscal side of it than being done on the economic side of it. And the economics of the thing are really being not looked at as closely as the fiscal impact would be on how much rate reduction you can get from this and how much this and this. Nothing on the full economic impact of the exemption.
I believe economic impact statements as well as environmental impact statements are defined in the statutes, and it would not be hard to include.
I would so suggest then
of that bill.
Mr. Chairman, it would seem, I mean, you probably could require the revenue staff if in fact it could be done comprehensively. I think probably during the review period that the groups affected by the loss of that exemption will probably have all sorts of data on potential economic impact.
I'm thinking of some of the small ones that aren't professional groups or don't have lobbies, business lobbies and so forth, they would not have the ability to do this.
As a statutory requirement, that would be part of the legislature's responsibility as well as the groups, or the groups' responsibility to provide that?
Well, the groups are always going to come in and try to take their best shot. And I feel that since the burden is being shifted to the group that is does have exemption, that the legislature should have as much independent information to weigh this against.
So like a fiscal
a revenue impact, and possibly an economic impact. Or an environmental impact statement on some of the environmental areas, I guess.
Depends how
on an impact statement on the economic impact statement.
Yeah, you'd have a fiscal impact, a revenue impact, possibly an economic impact, and possibly even an environmental impact statement if you're dealing with an environmental exemption. I don't know.
I get to pick the economist, right?
You get to pick the economist. Well, this is for the legislature to do, not for the product, so you can pick your own boss.
Would depend on how broad those categories are, Chuck. I think you could bog the thing down tremendously. I would think that it would be the job of the committee's research arm to provide the economic impact of and fiscal impact in the terms that normally they're provided now. And that could be a requirement in the trailer bill. It would be reasonable, but at least it's a starting point, and then somebody could argue with it that it wasn't complete enough, of which I think the group would do.
I just want to make sure that we're looking at the whole thing.
Comparing apples with apples.
That we're not looking at just the tax rate of a district.
Well, Scott, don't you think the people coming in will make sure that?
Well,
I know you will. You know.
I will. Right. But I'm thinking.
You got in the basic analysis to rely on the people who are supporting the exemption. They'll to come in with those kind of arguments. But you're talking about a shopping list and the standard and how thorough you.
I think what I hear Chuck saying is that rather than have these come in from the groups that are going to be bringing them in all different kinds of format, which they'll be supplying ample data, is for us to provide on a consistent basis some kind of a pattern of data.
Objective data,
so-called. But at least it'll be in a common format.
You needed the statute, though.
Well, I would say that at the time of the notification, our committee would have the responsibility of producing an economic impact statement or whatever we'd want to define it. I don't think that's an unreasonable request. Bill?
Chairman, Bill Fritz, Common Cause. I'd like to use what we used in a sunset bill that's now in the House State Government Operations Committee. What we mandated and what we put in the bill itself was that prior to the commencement of the review, well, in this case, we're talking about the state regulation. The agency charged with handling that regulation would provide certain things. For example, a statement of why the exercise of that power is necessary, a number of things. I think probably in order to make the review consistent throughout the, I think we're talking about four interims now, we might want to mandate in a statute just what revenue staff would provide.
Can we take the language out of there, Bill?
Probably to take the form. I'm sure you don't want this language.
You know, language deals more with power.
Yeah, this deals with power. But the form, I think you can just, you know, if you lay out when the review periods will be, if in fact we're talking about that now, or we're talking about the 77 or 78 interim committee laying that out, say that Group X will be reviewed between January 15, 1980 and November 30, 1980. Prior to the commencement of that review, let's put it, revenue staff shall provide 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 to the interim committee. And you could list the type of things you want and try to make that consistent so that the review each interim would be consistent based on and much the same type of data.
I think that's maybe a good way to go.
Glenn Patterson, Seventh-day Adventist Church Public Affairs. If I understand the way things work, you can only appoint one interim committee, isn't that right? You can't appoint an interim committee other than this current two-year session.
We can state that a committee will be set up under a particular ground rule situation, but we have no control over who is in that committee from session to session.
So if an interim committee in the next 2 years studied the situation and came up with a proper plan for the next session, they have a perfect right to do all of that. Then the next session, if they wish to do so, could settle all the whole program if they could move. Is that right?
That would be possible. Yeah.
And if they did not, then you'd be wide open again. The next session could decide either that they will or will not have another interim committee. Isn't that correct?
I would imagine that would be the prerogative of the 79 session, that's right.
So if it isn't done in this next interim, then you're stalemate, unless the next session continues.
I think if HJR 7 passes, it really mandates a review process that must take place over the entire 10-year period that we're talking about, which is four interim sessions. And the only thing I could see the legislative session itself doing is if they disagreed with what the interim committee had either suggested or done is making appropriate changes, but I don't think that they would be unwise enough not to have an interim committee dealing with reviews again for the next.
But there would be nothing to keep 2 years from now to have the legislature settle everything clear across the board if they could move.
If they could, handle all the reviews that fast, that's correct.
Absolutely.
The biggest danger is some group not getting reviewed by 1986 and then all of a sudden losing their exemptions right out.
Not too likely.
And that's not too likely to happen.
We can't tell the 79th session of the legislature what they can and what they cannot deal with. We can't do, you know, it's unconstitutional.
But we can set in statute the ground rules in which this process will be handled. That's the advantage. And I think that's the safety valve here in J.R. 7.
Mr. Chairman, yes. The other one is obviously if the people approve it, if the public suasion itself is going to, I think, give some impetus to the next legislative session to go ahead with the program. I can't imagine them saying, no, the people voted for this, but we're not going to do it. I've never met that kind of assembly before.
You haven't?
No.
Any others? Then really what we've done in the last two sessions is we've set down who will be doing this, that there will be, at least for this first time, a suggested format for the interim that is a joint committee. And we've set up the ground rules that to the extent that there must be some notification, and these are things in which we will agree in the entire committee before we can start getting them written into a bill form. And the fact that some kind of common information is provided in the way of economic information, fiscal information, that will be used in that committee as a starting point for reviewing any kind of organization that is going to be looked at or reviewed. Now, do I hear any, did we miss anything else?
Except I want to ask a question. When Bill and I looked at the statutes the other day, the statutes refer to a standing permanent revenue staff. They don't refer to any kind of standing committee necessarily that goes with it. And it seems to me we have to be careful in deciding the statute that the that this review procedure of economic impact or whatever else you write into your bill be assigned to that standing revenue staff rather than to a committee, or that you establish a committee. Now, the other thing I heard you say was a joint committee.
Yes, ma'am.
And I guess I had some reservations about that. We had, in view of the problems of senators being on standing committees, but I am a joint committee.
I think even though attendance has been somewhat less than perfect from that side of the legislature, the idea is basically sound that it would alleviate a lot of the problems of trying to, once a review had been made, to process it through both houses if they were working together and stop a lot of duplication in case it comes up again during session.
Okay, but what we want to set in motion, Tony, is an assignment to this revenue staff primarily, because they're all there all the time, and that they get underway on their job. The statute be directed to that rather than depending on the assignment of people to committees and the meeting of committees and a lot of things like this in order to ensure that this review procedure.
Mr. Chairman, I just wonder if that might not be a logical step to what I think is going to have to occur anyway, since we've created a professional revenue staff, an ongoing staff. It'd be a statutory joint committee on revenue. Just like we have legislative council and like our other statutory committees, and as a permanent standing committee, I think that there's some merit to that, especially if we're going to be referring to the review process that in the interim after the 78 election, in the event that the HGR 7 does pass, that committee is going to develop a plan to be submitted to the next assembly for the sequential review. It would seem to me if we're going to refer
refer to that committee, it might be a good time to take that stand. And I think, Mary, to in response to Senate attendance, I think that gives rise to better Senate attendance because they have a tendency to take the committee a little more importance than they do other ones. I know Legislative Council Committee, the Senate attendance there is much better than any other joint committee I've ever served on.
Well, I look at this, Mr. Chairman, as a similar function over here in the revenue side to an orderly analysis and review of the tax exemption system. Just as we have set up an orderly review and procedure going on the budget. And on the fiscal, in the fiscal staff, they are both, we're either in this side, we're just not collecting public money. Over here, we are collecting it and reviewing its expenditures and effectiveness. And I seems to me that the closest thing we can get to staffed operation with a steady assignment, the less of that apprehension is going in, written into the bill, the less of that apprehension is going into this, and the more assurance there's going to be to legislatures as they roll around that their task has been researched and set up and pursued with these questions other than some kind of a shoot from the hip consideration, which is what we've been doing.
It makes sense. I think if we went beyond the revenue raising the legal aspect, I think then we might be accused of moving towards a unicameral legislature, which people might balk at. But in these particular functions, I could never figure out why revenues were never brought together as a prime joint function because there's just too much hassle that goes on that we don't get done. All right. Anything else? Now, we will bring these suggestions back to the full committee, and it'll be announced. I think we're still open, I'm sure, to further suggestions that you may think about in the meantime. But I think these are decisions now that we can bring to the full committee and say, now let's decide which of these we're going to select as we build this trailer bill and see if we can put the language together that will set in motion in case it happens.
How will that be listed in the sheet? Nothing.
How will it be?
In the book.
Calendar, yes, it'll be in the calendar.
I know how will it be listed. It won't be HJR-7.
We'll probably be listed as HJR-7. Right. They have been listed as HJR-7 because we had no other number to give it out because we were forming the bill.
Thank you.
Any other things for the good of the order?
Could you review any legal questions that you left hanging that you wanted to put on?
Well, basically, double-check definitions, Ted, to make sure that such things as economic impact, if we use that terminology, what can we be asked the Revenue Committee to dig up for it. And the kinds of things that would set down any of the other new procedures as to locking in future legislatures, I think that has to be our greatest concern as we go with the statute. Right now, until we really, the committee makes a decision on which of these things we're going to do precisely, I would think your work is really not, don't spend a lot of time on it. So we made our final.
All right, we'll see what the attorney comes out with.
All right, then we'll start.
I don't think if there's any questions, but I like to, Representative Ricci's concept that you can direct your staff to do things, and that has some substance to it, but you can't direct future legislatures that are going to be doing certain things.
Would you check that out there and how we could write that up? That would,
well, the staff's in the statute to begin with.
And we could just simply, they're also, they listed in ATR.
You could say, no matter who's elected, the staff marches on.
I
hear
that. Love it.
I think, Chad, you can look at council and that review of rule process. They have to do that no matter what. Until some legislature changes the statute.
There you got a real firm hold on keeping the thing going.
Well, I think that ought to be in there. Yeah. I think that's a good
and we can work in the laundry list. And, that's the place to put the laundry list.
Appreciate that, Mr. DeLuca.
Thank you all for taking time, and we're adjourned. This is page
20, side 2. April 19, 1977, House Revenue Committee.
will. Before we start our discussion of tax deferral, why are we echoing? Did we
turn it down?
Hooked up somewhere?
There are speakers now in the system.
Can we turn off the speakers? Like you're talking to the chairman of the transportation review. To some of our friends on the floor tomorrow on 3209. The vote count to this point looks very, very good, but I think it's important if there is going to be a an updated vote count, so to speak, and to see if there are any particular problems that are available that people have that we can deal with. We will have the final run. We will, to the extent it's possible, first of all, we will deliver these to the representative's desk or their offices before the end of the day, and you folks will get the first run so that if there are any questions that you're dealing with, you'll have available to share the information with our friends. The floor debate, we thought that we'd break it up into some discrete chunks. I've already talked, I think, to most of you. But the first presentation, after a very brief introduction, would be, Tony, your discussion of the flat grant mechanics and implications of it. And then Robert will hit equalization and the trending that we think will take place under the system. And then Rod talking about IED, primarily IED equalization, and perhaps one or two other details, but particularly the distinction between the 25 and 4 and the elimination of IED equalization and where it counts. And then Ted to hold harmless. I think that basically takes the major items of the bill. And it just seemed to me that we just take those as a series of presentations that probably between are shooting for around 5 minutes each to just kind of set the stage before we entertain any motions or questions. And then particularly if Bill and Mary would be available to handle some rebuttal aspects that might come up. And since Representative Fawbush was kind enough to carry HARP, we thought maybe he could just be present and voting and wouldn't have to give any presentation unless the spirit moved.
I'm sorry.
That's fine. Representative Fawbush. We knew that you were.
We will have a handout on everybody's desk with the formula on it. It might be a good idea as we talk about each of these items.
We can have, for each of you, if you like, an outline of each of these four major areas. There will also be a committee intent statement, if I can just share with you what we're planning on distributing tomorrow. If there are any questions, additions, modifications, or violent objections to something that you find set forth, we would appreciate your sharing that with us. It would be my intention to, if I could, Tony, just turn the meeting over to you at this point to take the committee through where we've been.
On deferrals?
Yes.
Be-
between you and Ron here on the material that has been generated, and then we will, I imagine, be adjourning early enough that you'll be able to touch base with Greg or Ron or Richard briefly, just to organize the presentation.
Mr. Chairman, if you'll turn to the front of your binder is the report on the various...
Excuse me, Tony, if I just may interrupt just for 1 second. The Board of Tax Service Examiners, you'll recall, the budget for the board was returned to committee, and there were a number of us that had some concerns about that budget and about the board itself. Now, historically, that has been discussed by the Revenue Committee until they stopped trying to, that's been discussed by the Revenue Committee. There is no vehicle available to change the board to address issues like the fact that the people that were grandpersoned in when we enacted that strange piece of legislation in 73 have never been tested. There's no periodic reexamination, despite the fact that tax laws have undergone substantial change over time, and every indication is they will continue to do so. There are no members on that board of the who are accountants or lawyers who deal with tax law. They're all tax preparers, and there's only one public member. There are a number of changes that I think ought to be addressed if we're going to make that work. And my personal feeling is if we're not going to make it work, we just ought to repeal it and not have kind of the halfway job that we have now. I would like to know if there'd be any objection from the committee to our introducing, having drafted and introduced a vehicle whereby we could discuss these elements about the people that were grandpersoned in, the periodic retesting, the composition of the board. If there is no, the speaker is amenable to have some vehicle, and there isn't anything else out there, and so the budget is going to be in limbo until that happens. If there's no objection from the committee, the chair will request from the speaker authorization to have drafted a bill that speaks to the three elements that we've talked about here, and will be brought back to you for your consideration and introduction. No objection. Tony?
Mr. Chairman, we subcommittee that met on March 15th, and I have to refresh my memory as we go through it. On this tab here is listed the bills we talked about and what they took a statement of what those bills were meant to do. But on page 2, we did at that time seem to concur with items 1 through 5, and there was general agreement but should be then talked about here in committee. And we left about 4 or 5 major questions that really remain to be answered in the second part there. There are still some people who wish to testify on these, and I think it might be a wise idea maybe to take some more testimony on these, Mr. Chairman, as we haven't really agreed yet on what the common vehicle is for this.
Okay, well, let's then, Representative Crest is here. Tim, do you want to testify on 2041, some comments at this point?
I could very briefly, if you would mind.
I think that, Tony, is that...
Great. I think there's a number of people here who have had some additional thoughts that ought to be allowed to join us. Or
let's just do that. Jim, if you want, I know your committee's meeting at the same time.
No, it's not. I do have a bill that's being heard at the same time.
Okay. Well, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Representative Jim Crest, District 15. I can't remember if I did appear before the committee before on this bill or not. That was here, but I'm not sure if you got to it or whatever. At any rate, House Bill 2041 is the result of a bill that I introduced in the last session, and it was introduced, as you noticed, by the Interim Committee on Intergovernmental Affairs, which I serve, and at least one member of that Interim Committee here. And it speaks to a very definite and difficult problem of certain areas, and there's more than one within the state. And the one that I was aiming at in particular was in the what we call the Bridgeton-Paloma area of North Portland. That area was annexed through the health hazard annexation statute, forced into the area. It's a very unique area in that it's in a floodplain, and of course because of the health hazard it requires that they put in a sewer out there. Because it's in a floodplain, the water table is very high. There's boils in the land and so on and so forth. And they've had to do some unique things in order to put this sewer in that area. They've had to trench down much deeper than they normally would. In some cases, pour cement in on top to hold the pipe down on the ground. Crazy pumping stations, so on and so forth. In fact, one of the pumping stations that they installed out there, unfortunately, was put on a boil and it tilted, and so they had to go back in and redo this. But anyway, it's driven up the cost just extremely high. And I have the estimate. I don't have them with me here, but I think would give you a good idea of the kind of assessments we're talking about. And there are people out there, not just those 62 years and over, but certainly younger people too, but many of them that have lived there for many, many years, and their assessments are $5,000, $6,000 and up. There's a case of an 80-year-old man.
Can you get an idea of the property values?
Well, that's the other thing. Because it's in a floodplain, the property values are very low, in fact. $650, $800 for a 50 by 100 lot, which is very low. You can't build on it. That's the reason. Because unless you put it on 16 or 18 foot stilts. So anyway, you have an incident of an 80-year-old man who has several acres, 30 or 40 acres, that he's owned for many, many years, and has a $40,000 sewer assessment. $40,000. There are others that own smaller plots of land that have the same kinds of sewer assessments are similar. A woman who built her home herself out of what was left over from the Vanport flood, and it's a nice house, believe it or not, it's a pretty nice place, and her sewer assessment is in the tens, twenties, thousands of dollars. She's in her 60s. Now, you can bankrupt it. We passed a bill last session that you can bankrupt for 30 years. But if you bankrupt for 10, 20, or 30 years, the interest rate and the payments associated with it are going to be such they couldn't make the payments anyway. They're just too much. These people are on Social Security. Incomes of less than $5,000. Some families who have incomes of $12,000, $13,000, $14,000, but still their sewer assessments are going to be 15, 20% or more of their income. That's the problem we're trying to address. And the bill says they can defer it. When a property changes hands, then it'll be a lien on a property, or when it changes hands, whether they sell it or whatnot. The hitch there, of course, is in this unique situation is that they can't sell it, or they can sell it, they can give it away. I mean, that would what it amount to. If they could sell a property for a decent price and use that to make the sewer assessment payment, they would be able to come out all right. But they can't sell it because nobody wants to buy it unless they can pick it up dirt cheap because they can't build on it. So that's the trap that they're caught in. And literally, we're going to see people out there in that particular area be forced to give up their land, move off it. And then many of them, like I say, this is their, you know, they're going to die there. And they hope to. Go ahead.
How big an area are we talking about? How many houses? How many homes?
Oh, there may be 150, something like that. There isn't too many people out there. There's a lot of property, and it's vacant for obvious reasons. Some of it's pasture land and things like that. And it's zoned.
And total park. Cost of the sewer system in San Francisco?
Mark, what is it? Is Marcella here? What's the total?
Total cost of the whole thing? Wow.
It's something
in excess of $8 million.
Yeah, I was going to say $8 to $10 million.
Divided by 150 homes?
No. Raw industrial property.
There's industrial property, too. There's some of the industrial property has assessments of $80,000, $100,000. But we're aiming at, and there's other areas of the state that have a similar problem. Redmond, and I think they've done some things there, too. The Redmond had a similar problem. The problem out there was that they had to blast with dynamite and nitroglycerin to dig a trench to put the sewer in. So it drove up the cost. And we have worked for years, the city of Portland and the state, DEQ, have worked to get federal funds into this project to try and, you know, bring down the cost. But it still left about $3 million, I think, for us to pay off. And you're talking about some, and I'm talking about not so much the industrial users out there, because I don't know how in the world you're going to be able to help them. Down the road, someday, if the Columbia Slough is plugged, which is a controversial thing, it'll do away with that floodplain. And those property values are going to go up. And I want to set a hypothetical situation here. Let's say that you've got these people sitting there in their homes facing these tremendous sewer assessments. Their property isn't worth anything at this particular time. So they're going to be forced off their property, out of their homes. Somebody's going to pick it up dirt cheap. Down the road, in the future sometime, that Columbia Slough is going to be plugged. And what's going to happen to that sewered, cheap land? The property values are going to go skyrocketing straight up, and somebody is going to be sitting back just raking in money after they're able to pick up. Right. And all at the expense of
free enterprise system.
Free enterprise system. Right.
Representative Marks is not here this morning.
He's probably outside.
Can you speak? Well, I understand that Representative Seth already has an option. Very well. Are there, and you think 2041 is a step in the right direction?
Very definitely. It's going to help those at least 52 and over. The bill I had in last session was aimed at on income with no age requirements in it. Ideally, that's what I'd like to see, because there's people in low income out there that's certainly under 62 years of age that need as much help. So,
Jim, aren't we talking here also about a number of areas where the same essential process that took place in your district could take place elsewhere, where there is a health hazard annexation or some similar process where people are forced to have improvements that they may or may not want, so that it could very well range beyond the confines of your district, but may impact essentially everybody in the legislature in some degree.
Yeah, it could. I agree with you. It could happen. I think there's an area out in Lake Oswego someplace that there's a similar situation. You know, the income's a little higher out in that area than in my particular district, but it's a similar problem. And certainly there may be others down the road. When we talked about this originally, we said, you know, it'd have to be on a first-come, first-served basis, whatever we appropriate here in the legislature, and the money's there, and whoever gets their applications in first would be the ones that would get it, because you can't have an endless, bottomless pit here full of money to tap.
Okay, any further questions?
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman. This would take care of the Yahat Sticketeer, who was out in front of the Capitol the other day also. He had the same problem.
Yahat Sticketeer. I haven't had the privilege.
That wasn't Kyle?
No, no. That was the one at the... Senator Bowe and Representative Wang should hold an immediate hearing on the sewer on the Yahat of wherever, Waltport or somewhere. You know, here it is in the papers. Yeah. Well, anyway, he takes care of him. He's a retiree.
Representative Grinnell was not being disrespectful during, he was doing research on your problem during my presentation.
Jim, the only thing I'm wondering about on this is, do we encourage, by passing such a piece of legislation as this, a policy where cities or counties may go in and put in sewer systems into areas that really should not have them in there, on the idea that they're going to, the taxes will be deferred on to the people who own the properties or anything like that? Any kind of statewide policy that we may be getting people to venture on where they shouldn't?
Well, Tony, it may be, you know, some may see it as an incentive to get that kind of a thing done. I couldn't speak to the cities and counties on that score, and I'm not so sure that they speak to that either. But it's a possibility, I suppose. I couldn't. I don't know, maybe there's some kind of safeguards built into this. I don't know. I agree with you. You know, any time you get something like this, there may be abuses or attempted abuses. I hope not. I hope that people would see it as what it is, and then not see a way that they can ram a sewer system down somebody's throat.
Well, the safeguard in this one, as I remember it from the interim, was the a tight limit on the hardship cases.
Yeah, well, of course it is. I don't know if that would answer.
I don't know if that answers Tony's question, but the
these are so volatile, you know, these situations are so explosive. It seems to me that units of local government are very reluctant to move in this direction unless they're absolutely forced to by the stepdaddy.
Well, you were probably captured on land use Army Engineer floodplain designation all of a sudden on this, is that right?
It was Yeah, it's been designated that for some time.
It wasn't something you folks engineered at all.
It doesn't help hazard.
These people are already there.
You put in a sewer system. people are there, but yet the sewer system is so damned expensive, people can't afford to stay there once you put it in. It affects what you've done, and it just, and now you want us to bail you out.
Well, it's state laws that force it, I might say, Representative Bobbitt. Under health hazard annexation.
Thank you very much, Jim. We appreciate it.
I'd be glad to supply a list of the assessment and the ages and income of those individuals. I have that back in the office if anybody's interested in looking at it.
I would like to see it, Jim, if you wouldn't mind.
Thank you very much.
We don't have a formal sign-up sheet, but I understand that some of you folks would like to speak to these bills generally or the issues. Mark, just maybe if you want to just add, if you have anything to add after Representative Kress comment, and we'll just go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Mark Kelly, and I'm here representing the City of Portland. I want to get out of the context of speaking about the Bruce and Saloma area because it's an unfortunate circumstance that Representative Fabush has put in perfect context, and there's not a darn thing we can do about it but put the sewers in, and that's the end of the story. However, I think it's important to realize, in Representative Van Vliet's question, that counties traditionally are not what you'd call your normal urban service providers. That is, you will not find many counties in the state that have large sewage treatment facilities or large investments in sewers. And the same thing would apply to water systems. Those are either done through cities or through special districts for the most part. Multnomah County has one sewer treatment plant, and the inverse plant that takes care of East Multnomah County as an example. And then to carry your question one step further, I think it is entirely appropriate that areas that are incorporated within city boundaries become as urbanized as possible. The whole purpose in designating an area as a city is that there's an infrastructure there that can provide services to the people who live there. And it's at least the feeling of the City of Portland, anything that can be done to encourage that infrastructure to get in place and take advantage of all possible land that resides within a city is a positive thing to do, and does in fact discourage people moving out and the further promotion of what is the popular term has become urban sprawl. Around Portland, we've identified 8 pockets of land that reside within the Multnomah County borders and immediately abut the City of Portland, which are for all intents and purposes totally urbanized. That is, the density is no different than it is 2 blocks away where they're inside the city. Most of all of that area is unsewered, and much of it has substandard water, and a lot of it has county roads that are not up to par. If those areas were to become annexed to the city, the potential cost to the property owners is significant. It's ironic but factual that those areas also contain a substantial number of elderly, low-income families. It's Portland's feeling that the enactment of this legislation could make it possible for us to sewer and at least bring the water up to standard, that is, put in the proper hydrants by bringing in the proper size water mains to bring their fire rating down, and allow the persons who would qualify under this bill the opportunity to defer those taxes. As everybody, as everyone on this committee knows, the property tax deferral program for elderly citizens has not met with an overwhelming amount of response, primarily because of the reluctance of people to put a lien on their property that will be forced upon their heirs. However, work that's been done by the state shows that property values are rising so quickly that you can apply for that deferral and take the deferral. And when you pass away, your property can either be, can, let's say it's sold by your heirs, that the profit that is made off of that piece of property not only takes care of the deferral, but offers a substantial increase over what you paid for the dwelling originally. And it's at least our feeling that it's an option that that warrants the opportunity, at least to be used. I think that you'd find at least Portland, who has 70,000 senior citizens, or a little more than that, residing within the corporate city limits, about 22% of the population, it would be a tremendous benefit to us.
Mark,
Chairman.
You've got the gavel.
Oh, all right. Representative Van Fleet.
Mark, I guess I come right back to that question. Somewhere along the line, you reach a cost-benefit type of thing, and you, by the time you put in fire hydrants and sewer lines in this land that now has been classified unusable, you could almost go out and buy every one of those people a $50,000 house and relocate them and still let them keep the property undeveloped. The other thing is that those land values don't go up in their lifetime, and they are passed on. They may be forced somewhere along the line for that to be turned over to government because of the lien against them, if what Jim says has not taken place, and that is the value of the land has gone up.
Well, at least within the corporate limits of the city of Portland, it can be easily verified for you, Representative Van Vliet. The property values are going up on a regular basis, regardless of whether they're sewered or not. And I think it's important to realize that a lot of the areas that we're talking about here already have water of some sort, and the folks are either on septic tanks or cesspool. There has been a freeze put on building permits, and at least in two of the areas, one of which resides in Representative Blumenauer's district, there's an imminent danger within 5 years of health hazard annexation, which, as Representative Fogbush has already noted, is by far the least desirable option open to anybody, that is, the jurisdiction involved or the citizens. And what I would say to you, Representative Van Vliet, is that there is a tremendous built-in investment in those areas by the city and the county. That is, with the streets that are already there, any street lighting that exists, the curbs, the sidewalks, any water lines that are already in there, and at least our feeling from cost studies the city's done that can be certainly made available to this committee, that it would not be cheaper to close down that neighborhood and go out and build a brand new set of streets, a brand new set of sewers, a brand new water system, and buy them all $50,000 houses.
Well, how much have you got into the project already, Mark?
Into a given area?
Yeah.
Well, you'd have to take them one at a time, and we're doing that with some annexation proposals the city has right now.
But you've already talked about, what, approximately $3 million into the sewer system?
I'm divorcing myself from the Bridge and Paloma area completely. I'm talking about the much larger picture of the...
All right, I'm just getting back to the other because it drives you into that problem in mind.
And that's exactly what we want to avoid, Representative Van Vliet, is having an area where the state says you're a health hazard, your septic tanks are literally floating to the surface in the wintertime. We don't care what the land use designation is, you will annex it to the city and you will put in sewers and you will do it right now.
Yep. Unfortunately, we missed Representative Kress. I asked him a question before he left. He had expressed during his testimony that the bill would not be seen as a mechanism by which local government cities and counties could force this kind of development on individuals residing in a particular area. And I indicated to him, it seems to me that in this particular instance, the first example was given much of what Portland was planning to do. And I asked, does that change your thinking on the bill? And he said, well, not particularly. I said, does that mean that we need a safety clause in the bill to make sure that that doesn't happen? He indicated that that was his bill.
You have no...
No. I mean, if we never have another Bridge and Paloma situation, as long as we're a city, we'll have no objection. It's just that... And you have to go out and get the property owners to sign, unless it's a health hazard, to do any of these improvements now. You can't force it on anyone. So, no, we have no objection.
I think that it's the aspect that it can become a strong point, maybe to chip away some extra opposition, that kind of thing.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark. Mr. Crawford...
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Dave Barrels representing the Oregon Savings and Loan League, and Crawford representing the Oregon Mortgage Bankers Association, and we've also been asked to speak.
I
for the commercial banking institutions of the state. You may recall, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that some weeks ago, Mr. Mel Smith from the United States National Bank appeared before the committee to talk about the specific question that we want to address to the committee today. And that is the question of the priority of liens in the case of the Senior Citizens Tax Deferral Program. And we're not going to talk specifically about Senate Bill 34 or 2107 or whatever, Mr. Chairman, but just to refresh the committee's memory about the issues. We've handed out a very complex chart, as you can see. But that's about as far as we could go, I guess.
We're going to use this to explain 3209 tomorrow.
I guess the triggering language, Mr. Chairman, is the language at the bottom. During the first 5 years of the mortgage, the deferred taxes are senior to the mortgage. After 5 years of the mortgage becomes senior to the deferred taxes, maybe. And there is a question as to whether or not, under the example we've shown here, you have a borrower who comes in at age 60, gives a mortgage, and it's age 62, says, now I want to defer my taxes, which is fine, and we support the concept of tax deferral being available to senior citizens so people aren't removed from their homes. And then the taxes are senior for those 3 years until the mortgage is 5 years old. The individual is now age 65. There is a question in the minds of attorneys as to whether or not, in fact, if the state is in a senior position to start with, whether it always stays in a senior position. The prevailing thinking probably is not. But Senate Bill 34 does speak to that question, Mr. Chairman, which is a subsidiary question, and that is, once the sixth year of the mortgage comes into being, then the institution becomes senior, the lender, rather than the state. But the question, very simply, is what is the right thing to do here? It is our position, as Mr. Smith testified before, that it seems to us if the state desires to enter into a social program, which is certainly what this is, and we support the concept of it, that the state ought to be the one that's in the jeopardized position, if in fact there is any jeopardy. We don't happen to think there is. The state doesn't happen to think there is much jeopardy involved here. But in those rare cases where there is some jeopardy in the early years of the mortgage, we think the state ought to be in that position and not go back, in effect, to the savers in depository institutions and say, you people are the ones that are going to be in jeopardy during the early years of the mortgage. The other problem is, Mr. Crawford could speak to that, is what it does in our attempt to sell mortgages to institutions outside the state, which is crucial to bringing enough mortgage money into the state.
We haven't, to date, as you're aware from testimony that's been given, run into a large problem. What we're trying to do is anticipate one. I think that you understand as well as I do that people that are in the lending institutions do a great deal of prophesying to what's going to happen down the road and trying to avoid pitfalls. Probably the reason that we haven't had a great problem so far is the very thing that Representative Kress spoke to. There hasn't been a great deal of interest so far into the program, so there's no testing ground for it. But I think that as we go into the secondary market, and Oregon is one of those states that's been testified to here before that goes into the secondary market a great deal for its money because we are a capital short state, I think it's fair for us to be able to rationalize together that the lender sitting back there in New York or wherever, the person who's going to give that money to the mortgage banker to take care of these projects, to buy the portfolio, if he sees any preponderance of those where his money is going to be in jeopardy because of a tax deferral program in the state, it may very well be, particularly in a time when money is maybe not particularly tight, but is also not in great abundance, that he may say, well, gee, it makes more sense for me to put my money into California or Washington or someplace else that does not put my money in that kind of jeopardy. We're concerned about that and think it should be addressed, particularly, as Mr. Burroughs is saying, where we realize that everybody is saying, well, there isn't much jeopardy, but that's hard to explain to the guy back there who has a choice of no jeopardy or maybe not much. He's going to make a choice going the other way. We fear that as a potential problem in this program, and they're asking for relief from it now before it goes, because we would like to assist the state in seeing to it that the program does become more popular. There is hidden fear out there among the senior citizens that's probably uncalled for, and we think we can help with it. But at the present time, we aren't in a position to be able to do that because we may adversely affect the entire market in our state.
Thank you, for the record, how shall we label this chart? Date is 419.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I didn't know when it would come to, I guess, presented by the UFL, United Financial Lobby. I guess it was as close as Regent Cal, Mr. Chairman.
UFL. L-419-77.
You don't see any vehicle right now that this particular bill that we're working on is a vehicle.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear Mr. President.
I think George Meany has to sign off on it.
Were you directing this towards any particular piece of legislation right now that we have or addressing?
Well, as I indicated at the beginning of the Representative Van Vliet, whether it's the amendments we would propose would be different if Senate Bill 34 was your vehicle as opposed to 2107 being your vehicle. Depends on which vehicle you use. And obviously we would be more than happy if the committee made a policy decision that it was going to use this bill for the vehicle, and two, that they concurred with our position, sit down with Ron or whatever and work out the specific language. We think we know what the language would be, but rather than coming in with alternative sets of amendments and everything, it depends on which vehicle you use and what other changes you might make in the bill.
Now, we have a separate problem that must be addressed too, from our point of view. And this one is so incredible, I almost have to laugh every time it comes up, but it's very serious. And that's the problem that we've run into already with the FHA loan. FHA is saying to us, you must collect the taxes and pay them. We will not stand for it. Federal rules and regulations will not stand for it. And we received an attorney general's opinion that said that that's right, that if FHA is saying no, then the answer is no. Now, that would seem to clear the problem up nicely. However, believe it or not, one of the counties in the state has said to mortgage bankers, don't send us the money because we aren't going to take it, because these people responded that they wanted their taxes deferred and we won't take the money. So we're caught in a bind now of collecting it, the FHA saying we have to, the state saying that's perfectly all right, that's the way you should do it if they say it, and then a county that says, well, all that is an attorney general's opinion and that's not law, and the law says very clearly to us that if the taxes are deferred, requested to be deferred, they shall be deferred, and we're going to defer them.
What county is that?
It happens to be Multnomah County. It may have been worked out by now, but several months ago it wasn't. I don't think it has been, but I have not kept abreast of it to that degree. But the real point here is, Mr. Chairman, that we would ask in whichever vehicle you use to have language put on there in there that specifies where federal rule and regulation prohibits the participation in this program. Even though it seems fairly clear, at least it has to the Attorney General, that it does exist now, it's not spelled out in the law, we would ask for that relief. And I believe your committee has a copy of that AG's opinion. It seems to us it would help us in a great many respects. Certainly would be a great public relations thing for us to be able to say it's in the law instead of having to go through all this mumbo-jumbo.
It is, Mr. Chairman, the new subsection 4 on page 3 of Senate Bill 34, if that's the vehicle, and obviously could be put into 2107 if that's the vehicle. That line, the Senate committee did speak to that question.
Section 23.
It's on page 3, lines 23 through 28. The program doesn't trigger in if any of these, unless all these conditions are met. The homestead is not income producing, and there's no federal law or regulation prohibiting.
Fine. Any further questions, comments? Thank you.
Thank you for your service.
I have received a communication from Representative Johnson, Sam, that he has no objection if the committee wants to use Senate Bill 34 as a vehicle. He has no objection to having his 2823 tabled. Would there be any objection? Well, we'll get to that in a moment. Sam also is interested, wanted to have noted for the record that he thinks the interest rate, which is raised, as I understand it, to 8% in Senate Bill 34, ought to go to 10%. And would like that offered to the committee, and I think it will suffice that it is
but this is made, then it will be made a part of the record, and anybody who wants to make that motion can. Mr. Myers indicated that he's available this morning. Is there some sentiment on the committee that they'd like to chat further with Clay about this? He went back to his office. But
I know he was sitting here. I didn't know whether he wanted to testify again.
But my understanding is he did not want to testify, but would be available for any questions if they need to be directed to him. Betty, do you want to join us and make any comments, raise any points that you feel are necessary at this juncture? Are you representing the Housing Council?
No, I'm just seeing Betty Niven, who's been around doing this sort of thing now for several sessions.
Okay.
The Housing Council hasn't talked about this particular issue. But I am perplexed by what is described in terms of Senate Bill 2041. And I think that it speaks to some of the issues actually that were raised in HJR 8, but not recognized as such. But let me start by saying, first of all, if the value doesn't exist on the land, with the land, then I can see that there would be some problems with accepting the deferral of that Bancroft assessment, because it means that the state is not going to get the value of the assessment either at the point where the property changes hands, unless it doesn't change hands until all those other things have happened in the particular instance we were given, and the Columbia Slough has been drained or whatever has happened yet, and you reach the stage where those land values go up. So I can see some problem with the public policy. The assumption has always been that if you had an assessment, a special assessment, that assessment was worth less than the value of the land. The second thing is, or the property. The second thing is that I'm puzzled by the fact that assessment could be made as it was, at least under Bancrofting, there has to be a demonstrated relationship between the benefit and the amount that's being assessed. Now, Portland doesn't operate under Bancrofting, and so possibly they have something different in their bonding laws that doesn't say that, but most city charters do provide there has to be a relationship, and that appears to be a rather tenuous one if indeed you've now assessed much more than the land would command if you sold it. So there seems to be some kind of very odd circumstance at work there. Then the question is whether the DEQ regulations or the state legislation that says that you can, with a health hazard, you're entitled to annex and proceed to correct it, does that contain any exceptions, or does that say, look, the whole benefit can be that you've removed the health hazard and it has nothing to do with the value of the property? Now, if indeed that's the case, it would appear that that needs to be addressed, because we're talking about removing a hazard which is a hazard to all of the public and not just to the people who live there. The people who live there may have contributed to the hazard, but they were allowed to move there under public policies which let them move in and put in their septic tanks, did not stop them, and so this should not be a cost that is falling entirely upon the people who are simply living there because that was where they could afford to live. They were building them, in this case building their houses from old pieces of Vanport, and all of a sudden, you know, now they're hit with this. All right, we're talking now about something which is a public benefit, and we're assessing it totally against the cost of housing for those people. And that is really not a proper way to be going, and I don't know what the legislation says, but it disturbs me that this kind of situation kind of arrived, and I think that it's the kind of thing the legislature needs to look at. I might make one comment in connection with the deferral bill, because I should go off to a different hearing, and that is that in our committee session, we talked in terms of the issue that was raised by the lenders they're not wanting to have a junior-senior lien and not wanting to be the ones who say, no, we won't allow a deferral because we don't want to have that risk and so on. We talked about the alternative of having some kind of directive that said that it is up to the lender to counsel with any person age 60 and warn them that if they go into a deferral program and undertake this commitment that they may find that at the stage where one of them dies and the spouse is left with the property, that there is not enough equity value in the property to cover the cost of paying off those deferred property taxes. And I did draft some language like that, but I have not submitted it. In talking to the people in the housing division who have had a lot of experience in banking themselves and so on, they said, how are you going to enforce it? And you're adding another piece of paper. If you have any intention of enforcing it at all, you will put the lender's in a position where they're going to have to add something else, which is signed by the the borrower who says, yes, they have warned me about all this, and so on and so forth, and you're probably adding something that is really not going to accomplish a great deal. And so I've not submitted that, and I guess that I would probably withdraw that as a suggestion and merely trust that the lenders would feel some moral obligation to point this out, since they thought so keenly about it as to bring it before the committee as a hazard. I don't think there are very many 60-year-olds who go out and start and buy a house. Generally, the deferral has been something that was for people who had been in their houses a long time, owned them, and so on. So I will let that go at that. You do have a copy of a suggestion that I submitted at Tony Van Vliet's request concerning possible ways in which one might deal with a definition of income producing in order to allow for some kind of leeway. And the, there's a philosophical judgment to be made, perhaps, and that is whether in allowing for that, you merely want to consider the fact that somebody in need who ought to be able to have produce some income from the property simply in order to stay in it, or whether you want to consider it from the point of view of older people ought to have the chance to do some little thing and not be have their property invalidated for deferral just because it happens to make a little bit of money because they're crocheting hook drugs and selling them or something. So I guess from my point of view, that's a good argument, and I would be inclined, therefore, to think in terms of the fourth choice that I have on that list rather than any of the first three. The fourth one is actually a combination of concern about people needing money in order to stay in the house and being able to have a house produce some income without being moved out, because the first three all relate to how much money people can make and sort of tie it to being fairly poor. The fourth one does some of that in saying that there'd be no limit as long as you hadn't raised the household income to over $5,000 on the grounds that it needs to be that in order to have people be able to really remain in that house with any comfort. And then above that, I suggested an additional 20% of household income would be allowable, and so on. So the committee can discuss that philosophy. That's a philosophical question for the committee, but those were the best alternatives that I could think of that made sense, I hope.
Thank you, Betty. Shall we start with Senate Bill 34, just as is that reasonable, Tony, in terms of that might be the most convenient in terms of cutting through some of the potential problems we might have. That incorporates many of these. I'd like to deal with some of the separate policies that are already incorporated in Senate Bill 34 to make sure that let me just stop you for a second, make sure that there's no one else that feels that they want to have something that they have to say at this point, unsaid. Okay. Let's start with 34. One of the elements that's not in 34 was the first issue raised by the UFL. And the issue there is whether in lien priority and whether in a sense the language, what about language, but the concept that they're seeking to have incorporated is that the state never has a lien superior to that of the lending institution. I would just like to get some sense of the committee as far as the concept is concerned. Would there be any objection from the committee to having language drafted to incorporate that into Senate Bill 34? No objection? Ordered. Now, we have five major policy decisions that are included. First, in 34. First, I believe, Tony, your first 5 points here in the report dated the April 18th, transfer from the Treasury to the Department of Revenue. Is that agreeable? Any objection to that? Item number two, all special assessments on the tax roll should be included for taxpayers using the deferral program. Any discussion or objection here? Okay. Three, income generated from the property should be permissible. And here,
Excuse me, Earl, what are you reading?
The report. Very, very front of your...
Very front.
Very
summary
front
of the tax deferral bill.
The page two of that report. We've segregated the policy decisions here that the first five are already incorporated in Senate Bill 34, but I just want to make sure that they're, for the record at least, they are raised and that there is no objection by any committee members.
One thing that, Mr. Chairman, it
yes.
should be maybe mentioned on three is that that really is a very, very important issue when we talk about income generation for the elderly. It's not something that we can, you know, really brush by very lightly, because we're really setting a social policy that's been under fire for some time, and I think elderly people have got a considerable amount of concern that they're not able
yes.
to earn money.
Is $125 a month adequate? Is that a reasonable limit?
Well, I have great apprehension over limiting them at all, but you run into the problem where you might run into somebody wanting to put in a garage and type of thing, and that's where the main argument comes as to where limits should be drawn and the amount. It's the difference between hook rugging and polishing rocks versus running a full-fledged business out of your home.
It seems to me that the example that I've had thrown at me is the widow or widower who wants to rent out a room in their house, and I've never heard anybody object to that. And it seems to me that when we're talking about $1,500 a year, $125 a month seems to me to be a reasonable rental for a. I'm not quite, particularly when we're talking about lowering it to age 62 or 60, or in some cases, there are proposals that would take it even lower. If we get much above $1,500, I think we start raising other issues that might jeopardize it. I would think, however, that if we were talking about if the committee felt that was too restrictive and wanted to make a modest increase, say to $1,800, I wouldn't think that would jeopardize the Senate. Was this hotly contested in the Senate deliberations?
Not really. They discussed it. They thought $1,500 would be a reasonable amount.
Would there be any objection, since this might well be on the books for a while, would there be any objection to making the limit $1,800?
No, I still move.
I feel more comfortable with that. There's no objection. We'll do that. And we'll, the bill will be amended to read $1,800. The fourth item incorporated in 34 is to fund the program out of Treasury's excess funds, the float, instead of PERS. Seems to me sound.
Just ask for a brief explanation of that, Tony.
Well, mainly is to get away from using these various funds around and go directly to the Treasurer's office, which is where you have your funding done for most all state business. And that was the logic, if I can remember correctly, of doing it that way.
No, there's more than that.
Well, there were some questions raised about whether it was proper, the proper use of the funds or constitutional. And they also figured the Treasury had maybe $400 to $600 million that they used to make investments, on which they also figured about a 6% return on.
What does float mean to you there, Ron?
Is their excess funds, is the money they're using in the short-term paper.
This is something different.
These
float
as a general fund.
It's a float in a banking system, I don't think.
Yeah, it's not the same.
Floating a check.
It's a misuse of the term float. It shouldn't even be in there.
Float to me means the check I write on Friday based on Monday's per diem. Yeah, that's not what
means. No.
The term they've been using.
This was picked up off the tape and is probably a miss. Really shouldn't be used.
I might find a better word.
The cross out float, Ken.
For the record, we're just talking about the shifting away from reliance on public employees' retirement system and just using the this as paying this out of the excess funds that's generated by the state treasury, management of the general fund. And interest would accrue to that.
The public employees wouldn't pay for it.
Or benefit in a good year.
Yeah, that's right.
No, I certainly accept the concept, but these are where it
was this.
Okay, that is not the language that is used in the bill.
It does say excess funds. Not to dabble in words, Mr. Chairman, but I'd also hesitate to use the word excess.
Funds on hand?
Funds on hand. That's good.
We'll see if we can tighten down that language, Representative Grinnell.
I'm a little offended at the word excess.
If there's no objection from the committee, we'll investigate alternative language to be inserted at that point. But rest assured that whatever language we're using will not be close. Item 5, taxpayers with delinquent taxes being eligible but not deferring those delinquent taxes. Any discussion or objection here?
That was brought up, Mr. Chairman, mainly because some people have been put into that unusual condition, and so this would take care of it so that we can get those people able to defer their taxes.
Okay. There's no objection then to the policy decision, A, to using Senate Bill 34, and B, the policy decisions that have been made to this point, except we're raising the eligibility to $1,800.
What you have down here about the age of surviving spouse, that would change.
Okay. It has been. So we're talking about 1B has already changed that.
Yeah, 1B is in SB 34. It is in SB 34, but the subcommittee didn't make a decision. The subcommittee thought the whole committee
Let's just turn to that next.
We couldn't get any concurrence, Mr. Chairman. The trouble here is that so many ages are being used in various bills to determine retirement and everything else that's the basic problem.
Well, Senate Bill 34 would in effect not roll back the deferral if the surviving spouse was under 60, and would allow the deferral for the surviving spouse 60 and over for past and future. That's already in the bill. Is there any objection from the committee or
on what bill 60?
Yes.
We have another bill in it.
I'd rather make it 62, Mr. Chairman.
Well, it is 62 now.
Yeah. A surviving spouse is 60 right now also.
Right.
If it's a surviving spouse 60 within 6 months of the death of the spouse, then they can continue to defer the taxes. But if they aren't, everything that's been deferred prior to that time becomes due and payable. And this is...
I think if somebody in their late 50s is sometimes being the most productive period in their life.
Representative Grinnell.
No, I would have no objection to the concept of maybe that's found in Senate Bill 957, rolling it back to 50 for the surviving spouse, but any further than that, I would object. If the person that the surviving spouse is younger than
15?
Yeah, she's 23 and...
Go for a Groucho Marx.
What do you mean, she? What does
he mean? She. Well... In that case, also, I...
Now you've got his attention.
It's conceivable to me, Mr. Chairman, that surviving spouse may be 50 and was not the primary supporter of that family, or the other one that probably got the deferment might have been the primary support, and it's very difficult maybe for that person, 50 and or older, to retrain and be able to provide the income to maintain that household. But difficult for me to believe that anybody that's younger than 50 couldn't maintain that household.
I think it's so easy to drift away from what is the essential purpose of this, which was to allow people, this is where the really critical need is to allow people to stay in that house a little longer. And the age of of women particularly now, you know, is up around, the average age is up around 70 plus. I just think lowering this age in order to accommodate this doesn't serve an essential social purpose. We're trying to hang on to the state, helping with allowing the taxes to be deferred so people can stay on in a home as long as possible when they are already old and their incomes are already too low for the taxes. And you can do this thing. And I don't know, Earl, how to get at what the age is, but I think we should remember what its purpose is, which is not to defer those taxes forever, but to take care of at age 50, you sometimes, you know, I think you have a much better chance of making a different decision than you do when
you're 60
or 62, but you have to live quite a while.
Mr. Chairman, I essentially agree with Representative Rieke. I was just saying, Mary, that if I was going to buy any position at all that was going to march back, it would be the provisions in Senate Bill 957. I think Senate Bill 34 saying the surviving spouse, even if that surviving spouse is under 60, can continue to be affirmative, is too liberal.
Well, I think, well, we're talking about under 34, though, that it would just be for those taxes already deferred. It would not...
Oh, all right. I see the word already in there now, Mr. Chairman.
So that, is there any objection to that?
Let me make sure I understand this now. I'm trying to catch up. Let's say the spouse has gone on the deferral program and they've been deferring their taxes for, say, 5 years, mm-hmm. and it's been stacking up,
right,
basically as a lien. And he or she, let's say he in this case, is the major breadwinner, and he dies at age 67 and leaves a widow that's 55. Now, are we asking whether or not she has to, within a very short period of time, pay all of that taxes? Under 34, in the hypothetical you pose, the surviving spouse would not be required to pay the 5 years back taxes deferred plus interest. However, from 55 to 60, she would be required to pay the property tax. The current tax,
yes.
Okay.
And she continues on with the deferral.
Now, if she is younger than 50, then, but she would have to pay the whole amount. Is that right?
No, 34 doesn't have a 50. 34.
Oh. If it's been deferred, it doesn't have to be paid. 23 years old in the case of the Charleston. Yes. I'm sorry. Did you have something you wanted to say?
Well,
is there a misstatement
I think
here?
I think in the case of your person was 55, I think she would have to get to be 62 before she could defer on her own under the Senate bill.
She can continue to defer the already
deferred
tax.
The already one,
that's
yes.
Right. Otherwise, she has to wait.
But she has to get 62 and defer on her own.
That's
she
correct.
Can
yeah.
Defer any subsequent.
That's
tax.
Reasonable.
Under 34?
Under 34.
Then our statement, you
under
53.
Now,
you've got it right. And if she is under age 60, she can go ahead and file every year to defer the already deferred taxes.
Yes.
She has to pay the current taxes.
I realize
and once
that.
She reaches the eligible age of, and that's the question, is it 62 or 60?
Well, some of our material here says 60, and that's what I wanted.
Yeah.
Well, I'm reading off the summary sheet.
This was what we were talking about at the time, unless it was changed, because this was...
It should be 62.
It is 62.
It is.
Okay. So that ought to be even more. Okay. Is there, my reading of the committee is that there's no interest in changing that, there's general agreement that is a reasonable provision from Senate Bill 34.
Agreed. Ron, one question for me. Are there any circumstances when the deferred tax becomes due and payable on the part of the surviving spouse?
Change the use of that.
Yeah, they still have to meet all their qualifications. That's the principal residence. They haven't sold it.
Now, that deferred income, that deferred tax that has already been deferred.
Only the situation if they forget to file. That doesn't apply to them, it applies to everybody. That's another issue that ought to be
that I just listed here to be addressed.
Okay. Because no matter how young the surviving spouse is, if the surviving spouse continues to reside in the home, they can continue to, they can have the taxes that are already deferred.
Right. But they start paying themselves.
Continually deferred. But they must pay the current taxes until they reach the eligible age.
Okay. All right. And I'm also, so we're agreed to keep the Senate Bill 34 intact in this regard. And I'm sensing that there is no great interest on the part of the committee to change any of their age eligibility. We've taken care of the lien priority. Let's turn to the interest rate. Senate Bill 34 raised that rate from 6 to 8%. I think that's a mistake, personally.
I do too.
And it's not because I think that we ought to raise it to 10. It's hard enough to encourage people who should be taking advantage of it to do so. And since the major concern, in my judgment, for raising the interest was simply, since we are playing with public employee retirement money, there I thought was a certain fiduciary responsibility to have a higher rate of return. I do not have that same compelling interest in the current. Is there any objection from the committee to changing the 8% back to 6%? No objection. Ordered. One other concern I have in this area is changing the rules of the game when we're working so hard to just convince people that we're not going to be doing things like that.
How about an in? I know it sounds strange, Mr. Chairman, but it's always intrigued me why there wasn't any other qualification besides just age on this program. In other words, one had a huge homestead, let's say a mansion or what have you, it would pay him quite well to defer the tax liability. And my concern is that maybe we ought to establish some sort of ceiling or some sort of income limitation on it or something. Yeah, but just a thought. Age per se isn't a very good criteria, although I understand that an income
The problem I have with that, Bob, is that the value of property is not a very good criterion either. You have to talk about the ratio, I think, income to property value to taxes.
Taxes, yeah.
And then we talk about the other assets they have, how liquid they are, and I just think to do a job on that is not worth the trouble.
Make it so complicated that you want to have people take it.
Even a maximum income? $15,000, $20,000.
Do I hear 16?
Do we have a motion in that regard? Okay, let's move on.
Well, you know, there's no support for it in myself.
Right.
Fine. Now, I want to... one other issue. We just had it here a moment ago. I wanted to raise, and it has completely escaped me.
And before you the disabled taxpayer, there's also a notification procedure.
Right? Notification.
Yeah, it's on the third page. Top page 3.
All right.
That was a tough one.
I've got a letter of an individual that wrote this letter from the assessor to the individual saying that don't pay your taxes, it's all computer unpayable here in Marion County. It's not really the intent of the law, but there is some confusion in the law.
This annual notification bothers me. Tony, how far, if at all, were we able to get in terms of discussing ways to make it permanent unless there's a change in circumstance?
I have to plead that my mind is not that good on referring back. Maybe Mary can help me on this or Ron, but it seems by the time we had gotten down to point 4 and 5, we did not spend a great amount of time on notification other than the question was raised.
What's the feeling on the committee? I think particularly for some of the people that are in this circumstance, I just wonder, about the compelling need for annual reapplication.
You're into the whole enforcement problem, Mr. Chairman. And the
which is a question we brought up with $1,500 income limitations we have. How is that enforced? How do you enforce whether or not they sell property, change hands, making more income? I don't really have any answers to that. I don't know how serious.
Ira might be able to, I think Ira, maybe, or the Department of Revenue should maybe speak to this, because I think they can help us on the on the problem of dealing from it from the trenches.
Yeah.
And
let me just, did the committee look at the letter from Cecil Edwards?
No, that was Independent Revenue.
Cecil has some concern about the language that he received in a letter earlier this year, that if he failed to file his claim for deferral on or before April 1st, you'll have to pay ad valorem property tax on your homestead for the current assessment year and all deferred ad valorem property taxes, including interest, on your homestead for the past year. They'll become payable on July 1st, 77. And Cecil argues that for accident, illness, inadvertence, or any number of circumstances could cause overlooking the refiling that caused the age citizen to be subject to the penalties. He raises that point.
Could we get anything as enlightened as just a simple postcard notification to the person who's receiving the tax deferral, and if there's been no change in status, they would simply not mail that card back, switch it around the other direction. We get that all the time in other ways in which we're getting address changes, but they would just simply receive a postcard. If that postcard was not returned, there would essentially have been no change in their status. They would send it back only if there's been some change in their status.
What if they died? What if they died?
We get notifications.
We get notifications, I'll be sure.
That.
I don't know where Cecil Edwards got that letter. It sounded like it was a current one.
It was failure to file,
they only lose the deferral for the current year. The back taxes not become due and payable.
That's in the law right now. The law says they have to comply with paragraphs 3 and 4. And one of those paragraphs 3 and 4 says that there shall be no delinquent taxes on the property. Once they're delinquent, they fail to satisfy all the requirements.
Well, all right, I see
that's
what
how they're interpreting it.
The letter came from Harold right here in Marion County.
Well,
that's confusing.
Anyway.
Sure.
Happy New Year,
Joe. Cecil, there's one of those people that will
pick that out.
Yeah. Treat on income limitations change.
Only to look at former Secretary of Defense.
The first tax will become payable on July 1, 1977, even under the current law.
I don't know. This might have been a notice that would be sent in the first years of the bill, because it did provide, if you didn't continue to apply, you became that, but I think that was changed in 73, or
it was supposed to have been, but there's still confusion, right?
There might be there. You are correct, there was one section of the law that was not changed, but I think the intent overall is very clear. And
this letter is going out, evidently. Let's get the practical joke on Cecil.
Well, I'm sure it wasn't meant to be a practical joke, and I'd like to make a copy of it and have a copy made so we can look into it.
You'll be supplied with a copy of it. Is that something that the department can just take care of by?
Oh, I think we can call to Mr. Domagal's attention that whatever he's doing may be erroneous. And
what's the sentiment on the committee?
I was going to comment on what Senate Bill 34 does do as far as notice. Senate bill does require that annual notice go out to the Department of Revenue to people who have deferred the taxes, and Senate Bill 34 includes that you have to mail an application form for the next year with it. And then if they do not file on the designated due date, then a second notice is given to them saying, well, you failed to file, and if you want to continue the deferral, then you have to file, and I think the date is sometime in June. Or May, and you can do this by paying a late charge of $5 along with your application. So you do get a double chance here to file, but that's what Senate Bill 34 provides.
Could you speak to the administrative problems of not having annual renewal?
Alan and I were just talking about it.
Alan, do you want to join us?
Maybe Alan should come up here, because he thinks maybe there's not that much problem.
I'm Howell, Department of Revenue. It seems to me that under this plan, before the department would be administering it, we also administered inheritance tax and would know of most deaths and within a reasonable time. Also under this bill, we have a lien record in the county, much like a mortgage record, which would certainly alert the title companies in any property sale. It kind of seems to me like that maybe there wouldn't be the need for the annual notice for those two safeguards. Now, there could be, of course, an increase in income from the property, and they wouldn't be stating that annually, but it was still under the 1800. The lesser type requirements, yeah. But the basic things, are they still own the property, and are they still alive, we could watch.
Now, would there be any way on the bottom of their original application to state if there's any changes that they are required by law to notify, otherwise they wouldn't have to be involved?
But it seems to me that if we're talking about a procedure now which has two automatic notices, it would not be that difficult to send periodically, you know, put them on a cycle where they get annually or biannually a notice from the department advising of any changes in the law and what the requirements are, just so that we're talking about 1,000 letters at the, you know, 600 now. That would not be that difficult to me.
Do I understand, Mr. Chairman, are you speaking about removing the requirements for annual filing?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Very rare that a property would exceed $1,500 in rental income.
$1,800
income from it. And even if it did, it would just be so rare that probably not worth.
Well, they could be in this annual notification, it could be, you know, spelled out for them once again what the requirements are, and you know, there could be a notice that their deferment will be continued unless they notify the office that they're, you know, and that failure to make such notification in case they're no longer eligible is subject to certain penalties of law or whatever.
I'd rather have them file annually than subject them to penalties.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not interested particularly in hammering over the head with penalties, and I don't think that needs to be put in the necessarily on the. I just see this as being a postcard notification, address correction requested, so that if they didn't die and they didn't change hands, but they're, you know, they are living someplace else, that we might be able to pick that up. It might be an additional check, and to remind them. A, that they're still under the deferral, because some people might forget. B, what the requirements are.
We could go a little further with that, and this communique would ask them to sign and return, and it would state on it that their income is still not, property income is still not above 1800, and et cetera, if we wanted to go that far. And yes, it would be the department's motivation, not the individual.
Yes. Okay, is there any objection from the committee to eliminating annual reapplication and substituting for the application simply an annual notification by the department in simple form of just the requirements of the program that would be sent out and we could address correction requested. This is an additional step.
One question.
Yes.
What would be your mechanism then? You mentioned there are two sources that you can check for that. What kind of mechanism do you foresee in keeping tabs on this? I'm curious about what kind of search and seizure operation you might be setting up.
Cross tabs the list of deferrals with the debt?
Yes.
And with any action on the liens that you have in the
well,
county?
The lien, if it's...
Well, that's automatic anyway.
It's pretty much automatic because they couldn't sell without title insurance.
And then you'd have the address correction as a third.
Okay, what kind of timeline would that be?
Well, I think the bill provides that it be no later than the next July, isn't it, or August, somewhere in there. And it, of course, it could be longer than that. This kind of checking.
Can I have one more?
Representative Fobbish.
What? We have
600
individuals taking advantage of this now?
A little under
600. What kind of response have you been getting on the annual renewal? Have you been keeping it up?
Well, yes, they have, pretty well. See, this the $5 penalty for the late filing, and I believe that has to go out by certified mail, that particular notice. So there's a good contact there, and $5 penalty prevents them from just always waiting until the second time. And I think that's worked quite well.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mark.
You said there are, as I understand it, two methods that you can check to see if a death occurred or a transfer of properties occurred, and that is, are all deaths are reported through the your inheritance tax division, right? Inheritance.
I can't
tax.
Answer that.
Or if not, all. Not all of them are there.
I would assume that anybody that has
only
the
taxable,
would be.
Only the taxable returns, which are, is it only the taxable, or?
Well, there are computer, there is a computer list available for people that die in the state. That list is supplied to county clerks, to purge their voter registration list. It's readily available through the health division. If you don't get all of them, you could.
Okay.
I just don't see that being a...
Okay, well, I just want to ask a few more questions to get a feel of such. And okay, let's say you have a transfer of property. Would automatically you get all notifications of transfers, and if the transfer was made, say Mr. Jones, who's got 10 years back tax due, sells to Mr. Smith, and Mr. Smith, well, it's noted on his title report that these taxes are due, but it's not really discussed, or it's not ironed out prior to the transfer. The transfer's made. What happens? To the tax liability against the property still.
Yeah.
And the guy who ended up purchasing the property end up with tax liability too, or does the prior owner owe it?
It follows the property, as I understand it.
Follows the property. How is it handled now?
Under the present law, the county would foreclose the property in the next foreclosure.
Under next foreclosure, if
real property foreclosure, and under the bill. The state would foreclose it like a mortgage.
They would record this.
Yeah, it's recorded in the county lien records.
The deed, though, would be recorded too. I mean, the transaction could occur prior to the payment of the taxes.
Yeah. This is, I view this much like a mortgage without calling it a mortgage. And it has about the same safeguards.
Mm-hmm. Is the title insurance?
Well, I mean, the person is going to buy a property with a debt against it.
Should know what the debt is.
They should find out. If they don't, it follows the property, and it would then be foreclosed by the state if they didn't take care of it. That's supposed to be like buying a property with a mortgage on it that you didn't know about.
How do you get notice? Would you get your office get notice of all those sales, so even, or could the property, since it now doesn't, we've eliminated annual. If we did eliminate an annual filing, how would your office know whether or not that piece of property qualifies for the deferral or not? Do you have some way to check also with all the local county records, Steve?
Well, even though that isn't in the bill, that could be done quite readily. By the same token, if a notice is required annually from the department to the recipient of it, with a return address notice, you know, and so on, we'd have notice in that manner, too.
Yeah, but they're eliminating.
But we shouldn't eliminate that, then, is what you're saying. We shouldn't eliminate at least you sending out a notice with the address correction required on it.
Well, I would think you'd want to contact them once a year just to make sure they're still there. This is different than having them have to remember to file every year.
I got my questions answered, but I'm not sure.
Okay. Is there any objection to having the notification annual application eliminated and substitute for the notification by the department as we described? No. Ordered. Representative Tillies has a proposed amendment.
Situation came up in my own district. I would think, though, that it probably has wider application than we might recognize. I described this committee once, two or three months ago. Situation where a 94-year-old lady and her unmarried daughter, who happens to be age 63, own a house jointly. Under the law, the way it's presently written, they cannot take a tax deferral. That confirmed by the Attorney General. To include that situation, which I think is certainly a legitimate situation, I asked the Attorney General to come up with suggested language, and it reads as follows. Two or more persons, all of whom are at least 62 years of age, who together own or are purchasing in fee simple estate under a recorded instrument of sale, and all of whom reside in the homestead, may jointly claim and receive the deferral.
So they don't have to be related, just so
they're
both
old
and...
Right. I think it would cover the situation of two retired school teachers who are...
Yeah, and both purchasing.
Right.
An aged commune.
Yeah. Aged what?
Old
commune.
Yeah.
any objection to the amendment? Ordered. Any further item without regard to sexual orientation?
What is the what's the Bancroft type assessment question involved? It was on here. I don't remember.
I would like to deal with that separately. And frankly, that is still, I strongly sympathize with the plight of the people that are affected by that, but I just would like to have a little more time for that to settle. And we have the interim committee bill that's available to us, and if there's no objection by the committee, I would like to at least wait to address the problem that Jim raised for us to at least Thursday or Friday.
Okay,
I'd like not to mix that in with
the Bancroft out.
Well, what I wanted to clear up here was that if we're going to discuss 2041 and when and if, to at least point out the committee that Bancrofting doesn't resolve this question of the sewer assessments in a health hazard, for instance, or any other difficult thing where you're trying to increase the urban services. Bancrofting is not the determination of your assessment on Bancrofting, as Mark reminds me, is not on a basis of the benefit to the individual property owner. Bancrofting assessments have to be based on the benefit to the welfare of the area. So you can't relieve individual property owners of assessments simply by Bancrofting. Okay. It was misstated, and when we get back to that, it isn't pressure to take it up this minute. Point here is to make sure we understand what we're doing.
Yes. It's not in 34 at all, is my understanding. Mr. Chairman, question about that. Let's say a person has a house in back of a relatively low-grade commercial facility on a highway. There's a lot of them, I think, in rural areas. They've been running some sort of shop, a furniture shop, or what have you, out in front, and they have a house connected to it, kind of, in the rear. Is there some provision under the existing law, or is there provision under this, where those people could have their homestead, or that part that they're using, that part of the... of the building that they're using for their home to live in under the deferral program? Or I don't know how it's treated now, and I don't know. And what's your thinking in terms of allowing that kind of thing?
We've done that partially in 34.
Partially, yeah.
How?
They're not unusual things, either. Depends on if their tax lots are separated out.
I think so. I think that would be an approach.
No, I think it's not going to be so much. George, how would they be treated now?
How would they be valued?
If they wanted a tax deferral on their homestead and their house was, part of their commercial building, an extension of their commercial building.
And Bob, I'm not too sure what the Senate Bill 34 addresses that in Section 1, Sub 2. when the definition of homestead is located in a multi-unit building, the homestead supports the building actually used in the principal dwelling as pertaining to the value of the common elements and the value of the tax lot upon which it is built. Percentage of the value of the unit consisting of the homestead compared to the total value of the building exclusive of the common. I don't know whether it does or not.
That sounds like it does. There are duplexes and
apartments. You're looking at the apartment
complex. It was written for that?
It was written with duplexes in mind.
Yeah.
Okay, but would it apply to, I'll give you some example. All right, you're talking about the Dayton. You know, you're driving around Dayton on the highway. Somebody's got a junk shop out in front and his house is built right onto the...
a second, Bob. We're really having trouble. The tape is being fuzzed by 15 conversations are going on. If we could just have one, just so at least we could get this on the record, it would be helpful.
Well, I think you know what I mean. They've got the junk shop out in front, and one building essentially, and they've got their homestead in the back or their home in the back of it. You think that the definition of homestead in Senate Bill 34 would probably cover that instance, even though it was meant only to cover duplexes or fourplexes?
I don't think it would. I don't really know for sure, but
I'd like to do some checking on
that. Yeah, let's look at it.
Okay.
It only speaks of a multi-use building, not multi-use property or land. It's another problem.
Multi-unit?
If we said multi-use building or multi-use property.
That's what I
want
to check on, whether multi-unit would cover his situation, Mr. Chairman. I don't know.
Well, I think you want to cover it anyway, is it?
We're starting to move, you get in that aspect of it, you're starting to move away from simplification of a protection of the homestead type thing.
What I'd like to do, if it's the committee's pleasure to pursue it, I'd be more than happy to consider one of the 19 vehicles that we'll have left in committee that we'll be tabling. I'm very reluctant to see that incorporated in 34 at this point. But if the committee, after we get some Bob, if you want to pursue it,
I'd like to know whether it covers it now or not. The way I read that, I would say that my impression is that it might cover an instance like that. But
it seems to me the intent of, Ron can speak to this if I'm wrong, but the discussions that took place in the Senate and where we are to this point is that we're talking about a multi-unit building.
Right.
And I think you're going to require, it's going to require separate language. To be able to, I also think our friends in the Department of Revenue and the County Assessors are going to be construing this rather narrowly because of the potential for this getting out of hand. So that, coupled with the record, I think you're going to require, it's going to require another amendment. And all I'm asking is that this be considered in separate legislation. And time will be available if you want to, after you confer further with Mr. Jones. Is there anything further to come before us in Senate Bill 34? Any other amendments, discussion, objections? Anything you folks in the Department of Revenue or other friends in the audience want to share?
Could we have a day or so to take a look at the annual filing thing?
That's one of the reasons I want to move it out now.
Okay. I don't think there's any big problems, but...
Okay. It would be in order to have a motion on final disposition of Senate Bill 34, if there is...
As amended.
Representative Klein moves that Senate Bill 34, suspended and gross, sent to the floor with a due path recommendation. Any further discussion, comments? Charlene, would you call the roll?
Aye.
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 Fine.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Aye. Ordered. We're adjourned. Is there anything needs to come before us? We're adjourned.
I think we will call ourselves a subcommittee this morning simply for lack of
anything else.
For lack of bodies. Earl apparently will not be down this morning. And Mary Ricky said she'd be a little bit late. The others are unheard from at this point. Victor, would you like to lead off this
this morning?
Yes, if you don't mind, I'm here directly on Senate Bill 543, but I can also speak to
409.
We introduced Senate Bill 543, which adds one other method that districts can go for a serial levy. Present time, districts that go for serial levies do it in dollars, and that's what the voters make their determination on. Presume for a moment a 5-year serial levy. Districts generally anticipate the gross needs for a 5-year period, go for the entire amount, which usually in the first year is more than is required, and in the last year is less than is required, or at least they try to work it out in that fashion. And that needs to be in dollars and cents, and as you can see in the bill, it describes exactly how it's to be done. On page 2, starting on line 12, which we're creating a new subsection 2, and what this would do is that the voters would go out on a serial levy on a rate, $2 a thousand, $10 a thousand, whatever it happens to be, whatever they want to go. And the rate then would apply to the taxable value in the district. They then can use that taxable value in the district for whatever period of time, which is up, according to law, can be up to but not exceeding 10 years. I don't really know of any that's gone for 10, but most of them go for less number than that. But can, nonetheless, by law, go up to 10 years on the serial levy. This then would, if the people approve it, would allow the district to apply a tax rate. Now, the very obvious thing that would occur is it's presumed that the values in the district will go up over whatever period of time is involved. But that same tax rate would apply. As the values go up, of course, the dollars that would be collectible would be higher also. The arguments against it, of course, is that there are some who are concerned about a tax rate, worried that, first of all, it would bring into meaning the fact that the assessor is the one that determines how much I'm going to be charged, and very obviously, if the values go up, the dollars collectible will go up, and that, in fact, the taxpayers won't really know how many dollars are going to be collected by that taxi district. That's true. On the other hand, however, it's a decision by the local taxing district whether they want to do that. And I would presume, of course, that the opponents of a tax rate levy would be making those arguments, and the people in the district will make their decisions in regard to it. All this does is allow this to be done. Allow it to put it before the taxpayers, and if they accept it, fine. If they don't, that's the nature of things. I think it's a good added tool and would be of value in the districts if they were able to get the pass. So all this does is allow another way of doing it. I can tell you that I know, at least in Washington County, that we've tried for serial levies under the present system and people have turned it down. And occasionally they accept it. So all this is just one more tool for doing it, and it's on a tax rate basis. That's what the bill does.
Thank you very much, Henry. Any questions, Tony?
Vic, if I understand this now, this rate would apply only to that particular levy. And if you're in a rapid growth area, what you would really essentially do then is probably pay off that levy shorter than the 10-year period. It's sort of almost like a self-liquidating.
It could be for that purpose. It could be for an operating levy for a period of time. You know, for whatever purpose they want to design it. Could be for that also, yes. But it isn't exclusive to that. It could be for an operating levy for a period of time. It could be actually, you understand, this is for any district. I was thinking, of course, the school districts being one that would be used, but I'm thinking in terms of the Washington County, we had a road serial levy, which was very important, and it could be very significant in something like that. So, but it could be done for a specific purpose. Let's take a road, a bridge or whatever, and it could be paid off sooner.
Okay.
I don't have any trouble with the roads or bridges. I might have a little trouble with school levies operated that way, because you get to using that money out there and then you get sort of hooked on a set spending. You're correct, but the same thing could be said of any serial levy under even the existing system. Any serial levy would be the same thing. In other words, you're used to getting that money and whatever it is the voters decided on. My argument really is that those are the arguments that we've used probably against the serial levy, if anyone wanted brave enough to try it, and let the people decide what they want. That's, you know, it would be their decision. It's just another offering tool, and if they were good enough to sell it, fine. If they don't, they won't make it.
Senator Atiyah, let's assume that a school district decided to implement this, and I can see in rapid growth school districts such as the one where I teach in Tigers, which is also happens to be in your district, that this could be very valuable. I know that that particular school district has shunned away from going for an updated tax base simply because it would become outdated in 1 year. And so they thought it would be a futile effort. And I can see where this 10-year rate base, just what it would be, rate base serial operating levy, could be effective. So let's assume that they got the voters to accept this at a certain flat rate per thousand, and that the true cash value grew at such a rapid rate that they found that they really didn't need that much money. Could the school district levy less than the rate that the voters had approved?
Yes. Well, yes. They're authorized to do this.
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is if the voters authorized, let's say, a $12 per thousand rate, and the school board, with input from the community, determined that next year they only needed 11 and a half, they could levy lesser amount.
Yes, all they're doing is they're authorized to do up to this amount. There's an authority to do it. It doesn't mean that they would do it. It means they're authorized to do it. Now, some would question the restraint, but point theoretically is yes, if they're authorized to do it.
Well, I've been one that's contended for many years that the proper control over school districts and budgets and so on should be control of the school board and its activities and the election of the school board. That's the proper avenue, I feel, of local control. And so this sounds pretty good to me. I think you'd still have that local control. You'd still have an opportunity. The voters would have to approve it, and the voters could go to the school board in subsequent years during the duration of this serial levy and say, we want you to control the budget. We want you to keep it in line. If you don't, we're going to replace you. We want you to make cuts here and here. And the school district, school board would have to be cognizant of those needs. So I wouldn't have the fear that this would lead to rapid inflation in school district budgets. Do we have any further questions for Senator Atiyah? Wayne?
I'd like to speak briefly then. I came for 543, but if you don't mind, say a few words about 409.
Appreciate
it. As you recall, one of the problems, at least I think one of the problems that we had last year with school closures is we got down toward the end of the year, and especially the very late elections, and especially, of course, the November election, the sale, which schools had to close because they had to wait till January again before they had another election. That, of course, was because in the statute we specified the dates upon which elections could be held. So there were some of us worried about that, and there were in our Senate committee, Senate Bill 409 and another measure. The other measure repealed all the dates. This bill, as it came to us, was as you see it in front of you. We amended the bill, and it was my amendment. Actually, it's the same amendment that you'll find in SGR 7. And it would allow another election with a petition of 10% of the voters of the last election. We decided then in the Senate committee to continue the dates as they are in the statute, but allow another election if 10% of the voters, and it would be, the measurement was 10% of the voters who voted the last election, was the measuring stick. They got a petition, and there could be another election. Now, I provided for you a sheet of paper bigger than this, but it has this kind of information. And the reason I did that was to show you effectively when this could really operate, and it could really only operate right at the end of the year. because it talks about two elections. You have to have had two elections that failed. And so the very early elections won't work for that reason and another reason. The other reason is that by statute, you have to be 35 days between elections. That's a statutory provision. In addition, in this bill, we talked that the signatures have to be verified within 5 days. So now we're at 40 days. So the reason I provided this for you is to show you actually when this would be effective. And it really would be effective after the September election and after the November election, prior to the January election again. And I think this will then, and of course, if we get down to that point, this is when it becomes very important to have the possibility of another election. And that's really what 409 does. It leaves the election dates, but does allow another election. But effectively, if you look at these numbers, it can only really operate at the end of the year.
Question. I take it that if this would also apply to if ballot measure one was passed, if it counts as an election, that this would count for two failures if they worked in another election. And I'm thinking if I was a strategist on a no vote on a school budget, and we vote down a school budget on September 20th, and I've got a period of time to get ready for the next one, and we're trying to muster forces to cut budgets and things like this. But if I wanted to guarantee a second defeat of that, I would get right away and go out and get 10% of the voters and try to get that on the ballot again as soon as possible and get it defeated.
Yes, if you do that, then the operation of this would really be a longer period of time before the next election. Now, for example, let's take the September 20th date, and it failed on September 20th, and you'd rush out to get the signatures for another election, which you could hold. And let's presume it was held and failed. It would be too late to come to the November 8th election because you don't have 35 days in between. And so then you would have to actually wait till the January election, so the school would be closed a longer period of time. That's correct. I hope there's no one that vicious out there, but you're correct. It could operate that way.
Yeah. Do you have any further questions?
One general one. Have you seen any figures, Senator, as to exactly what type of changes are made from election to election? I'm curious, in the school districts around the state, when they go to multiple elections, do they really change their budgets? Or do they run the same budget out time and time again and just wear people down until finally they get it passed?
There's no science to my answer, but I'm just, from my own personal recollection, of noting that most often school districts reduce their budget. Some, I would say, a token, some to some degree of significance, but most do. I have known instances in which they came back with the same budget, but that is rare. Now, I understand there's no science to what I'm answering you, but it's just my own observation over the years. So they usually reduce the budget to varying degrees. And rarely do they come back with the same budget. It's been done, but that's not very often.
Any further questions? Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank
you. We appreciate your joining us. Revert to Senate Bill 543. Chris Hadley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could I ask Mr. Anderson to join you?
Please do. Politics
kind of
separately. Politics makes strange bedfellows.
We alternate on bills. Every other one we're
together.
Something's wrong. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to just say that the Legislative Committee of the School Boards Association did have an opportunity to review this proposal, and the credit for this type of approach must go to the OEA, because they talked to us about this early during the interim as a possible additional alternative way of looking at the school finance problem, getting some stability in the structure. And our review of it, our interpretation of what it would do is just that. It would allow districts, rather than going annually for an excess levy, to have some kind of program adopted to seek voter approval of a serial levy for operations that's based on a rate rather than a set dollar amount. Currently, if you seek approval for a set dollar amount, you know that traditionally the cost trend is upward from year to year, and you have to front-end load that levy. You have to levy more than you need the first year of it, and you know, push that forward through the term of the serial levy in order to get a balanced revenue source to fund the program. We believe this is really a more rational way to approach it, recognizing that property values have increased 10, 11, 9, 13% a year, which is fairly closely related to what kind of cost increases we've seen in school budgets. So we do support this measure.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is John Danielson, and I represent the Oregon Education Association. Noting the sign-up sheet where our current assessors signed up representing the taxpayers, I would also wish to point out that I also represent 23,000 taxpaying citizens of this state. And sometimes I think people forget that because of the nature of the income of my clientele. At any rate, as we begin to look at legislative alternatives over a year ago, we determined that we needed to establish, and I think as a top priority, not only for schools, but for cities and counties and the whole business, some stability in the financial structure of local municipal corporations. And we noted that one of the things, of course, that was going to be before this assembly was some kind of a tax stabilization measure for schools, or a variety of tax stabilization measures for schools. The tax base or the district's authorization to levy or whatever the case it may have been. All right, as it has been now, it's ballot measure one, safety net or whatever. But as we look at that, of course, we recognize that it does take popular approval and in order to pass. And if you pass a tax base or tax base in authority throughout the state, it has an air of total permanence about it because it is constitutional law. And so we thought, well, maybe if people don't want to go that far, maybe they will be willing to establish stability for a shorter period of time. And in this case, then, we have added an alternative and attempted to make something that would be workable in some places, sometimes, to establish stability for a shorter period of time. I think as we view tax-based measures, and I think I've worked on five of them over the years at the polls or out in the field in elections, and the popular thing is, well, we don't know what's going to happen 20 years down the line, or what happens if we have another Great Depression, or you hear all of these things, and who knows what's going to happen in the year 2007 or whatever else. But we do look pretty closely, and we can pretty well guess what might happen in terms of things in the next 4 or 5 years or 3 or 4 years. And so we thought, well, the local people should have an alternative to be able to resolve their problems through passage of something for a shorter period of time that would add that stability. Question is, do you have that now? We don't believe the present provisions of Article 11, Section 11 necessarily give them that stability, but we also believe, because it is a totally permanent vehicle, that it does cause some problems in passage at the polls, and I think the record of passage of tax-based measures would indicate that they're somewhat difficult. But if it was only for 3 years or 4 years or 5 years, then people, you know, if they felt like they were taken once, why, at least if they knew the thing was going to be undone and they were going to start over again and have another shot, then we believe that they might give that stability that's needed to the city, the county, the fire district, the school district, the community college district, or whatever. So that's why we submitted this kind of a proposal. Now, effectively, what happens if you pass this type of a serial levy, or if you submit this type of serial levy, you're saying that you will be able to pick up the amount of tax in that particular district that dollar levy or that dollar rate will levy for the period. Now, in most instances where this would be usable, I suspect would be in cities and counties. You're not going to be taking the same growth as the rate of property increases on your entire budget, because most of these cities have a tax base that's very close to the amount that would be operable for their situation. So you're going to be looking at $1, $1.10, $1.60, $1,000 to carry them over a period. And that amount of money will probably carry them, that rate of tax, for 3 or 4 or 5 years and cause them not to have to go back to the polls. Their alternative is the annual operating budget, and or the annual operating levy to go with their tax base.
And we think that is a cumbersome proposal and something that has to be done every year. I think that Chris Dudley's point needs to be emphasized, and I think Portland and Rogue Community College are about the only two school district-type organizations, and of course, Community College is not a school district, but they're about the only two that have been operating off of a serial levy. They operate off of a serial levy, and what they do is they front-end load. In other words, the first year, they're going to levy more tax than they need, and then it's going to average out. Well, we don't really think that's necessarily, well, we know that's not politically a very viable alternative to go out and say, well, look, we'd like to levy a little more than we need now so we can spend it later. That doesn't really receive too good a reception with the voters. And so we think this does, in fact, inject the serial levy as a viable alternative. Now, we've heard some people have said, well, my gosh, the property in certain parts of our area increased 20% last year and 22% in certain categories. And certainly that's true, that it has done that in some instances. And I would point out to you that the general record, if you really review them very closely, would indicate that members of school boards, city councils, and county commissioners are not swinging crazy liberal spenders. And they, in fact, are not going to abuse the privilege. If there are too many dollars coming in, I think you would see on the record that they're cutting those back to the property taxpayers. I think you've seen a good record of that in school districts where they have cut back excess revenues back to for the purpose of reducing the tax. And again, I would emphasize that in spite of the fact that the property tax may increase 20%, or the property valuation, if you're only talking about 8% of your budget picking up that 20% increase, it really doesn't amount to that much in the final analysis, but it may amount to enough to prevent you or to make it unnecessary to go out for another election. Again, it should be pointed out, nothing is imposed automatically. It must be submitted to a vote of the people, and it must be approved by a vote of the people of that particular municipal corporation. And it presents one more alternative, and hopefully in a way to stabilize this municipal corporation financing in Oregon. With that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony.
Thank you very much. Do you have any questions? I'll direct mine to John. You know, I see some real advantages in the serial levy because it does spread things out. I have great difficulty, John, with separating the difference between one that is paying off something such as a school building or a bridge or something where you're done, it acts like you're amortizing over time, versus the operating, using serial levy for operating funds. Because it gets you into the same kind of jam we constantly get ourselves into here. We get additional revenues, we spend them, and we get hooked into the future onto having to maintain that level of spending. Now, what do you see a separation of those two issues?
Well, certainly on bonding, Representative Van Vliet, I would think any time that you can project a specific cost, and of course you can't always do that in construction either because of inflation, but you come as close as you can, then I think you would go with the status quo, which is simply to submit serial levy for X number of dollars to be paid off in 10 installments or 5 installments or whatever the case. I don't think you'd see them going the rate system on buildings because I don't see the requirement for that. I think you're going to see that rate system reserved pretty well for operational purposes. I don't believe that as we would look at it this time or if any of the economists that I've seen and read the projections on as to what they're seeing out there in the next 3 or 4 years, I don't see a one that projects a stopping of inflation. There are a few that say we might stabilize it, a few others that say that it's going to accelerate again. Very few are even saying it's going to modify to much of a greater extent than it has now. And these, of course, are policies that we really don't have much control over. It's pretty well a situation that's controlled at the federal level. So I think that what you have here is something that I believe if you submitted this type of a levy for buildings, that they'd just knock it down every time, and that would be that. I think the only really practical place for it is in operating levies.
So you mean a school district that would, because of the rising value, true cash value in a, you know, let's say a moderate growing area, and those dollars coming in, and let's say we're going to use it for school budgets, would not spend that amount of money and keep committing themselves to that amount knowing it was coming in?
The money, they wouldn't have to levy at all. No, I don't believe they would. I think that there are many, many examples of places where school districts have passed their levy. They've seen basic school support money come into them, and they had estimated at one percentage level the support money came at a higher level, where they have put that money back to the taxpayers as offset. I don't believe there is any record anywhere for showing that school board members, at least, are big spenders, and in fact, I think generally the record would demonstrate, at least over the last decade, that school board members are probably more fiscally more conservative than most legislators.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, I also, when Senator Teal was talking about this point, I also wanted to respond to that. I think if you look at the green letter that George Anella does from number 11, March something, it shows 35 or so school districts that have, in fact, this year reduced their property tax levy. If you look at the history of the Beaverton School District, a unique thing about our state is the levy authority you get at the polling place has no statutory tie or relationship to the budgeting process. It's an authority to levy. Okay, in the Beaverton School District, prior to the last year when they had that horrendous budget problem, would get voter approval of an amount that they could levy before they really knew what all the revenues were going to be, because you don't really know that until the close of the fiscal year. You've got an audit, you know what's available. When they determined the dollar amount in their cash carryover, they then reduced the levy they certified to the county assessor below the authority they had to levy. And Beaverton is not alone in this, but that's a good example of it that traditionally and historically happened. The Cascade Union High School District this year has got a tax rate of probably $1.20 lower than last year, and basically it's the increase in basic school support money. They don't have a tax base, but they do. That shows you that if there's a fluctuation in revenues, that they don't necessarily continue to levy taxes at the same level. The way this particular thing works, the school district would have authority to levy at a rate, a dollar rate, but would not be required to levy to that amount. And they do not lose levy authority if they don't levy to it in a given year. And that, in a way, is an advantage, because then they know that they will be able to come back the next year if they need it at that dollar rate. And it's not like a tax base. If you levy less than it, you start losing. So you've got some flexibility there.
I was just going to say, if you're saying that we've got such prudent people operating out here, then what really is the need, other than the fact that this brings in great gobs of dollars in a very fast rising true cash value area? You know, if we've got people operating this prudently on these school boards, and we're going to and on any kind of government on some sort of rational basis, then under the existing system of the serial tax levies, we'd say that was fine. But this thing brings in boodles of dollars under a rising true cash value area.
Well, Linda Van Vliet, I would guess that there aren't that many places where people would want to do this. The big problem that we have is we face school elections each year, and of course we're looking at over 400 of them every year, which isn't really that staggering considering we've got over 300 that you'd have just to get started if everybody passed the first term. But we've got over 400 elections a year. An average teacher working in some of these districts in a 30-year career is going to be looking at something like 90 elections that they're going to have to be facing out there in order to keep their livelihood going somewhere along the track, which is really, actually, if you really look at it, to put somebody up to that and say, okay, you're going to go into a teaching career today, and it's going to be stable as long as somewhere along the line in these 90 elections that you approve 30 of them at the right times in the right places, it's kind of a discomforting type of thing. And we think that not only teachers, but employees and other types of municipal corporations ought to have the chance once in a while to go out there and say, look, let's have 2 or 3 years of stability. Obviously, I don't think that we can say that school districts have any monopoly on the problem of attempting to pass budget elections. In fact, I think the record would show that cities, counties, and other municipal corporations, with the possible exception of park districts and fire districts, they have more difficulty than the school districts do. But you're not looking at a growth on that total budget, because your serial levy will not be imposed in 99% of the instances on the total budget. It's only imposed on a very small portion of it. Portland Public Schools has got, what, a $7 million serial levy now? Out of what's your total budget, Chris?
Gee, I don't know.
$100 million or $30 million, is that correct?
Right.
Right, so if they imposed a rate serial levy on $7 million, or in other words, what it would take to raise that $7 million, they would have an operable serial levy, and the people would know precisely what they were looking at to fund that. But it still would represent something like something less than 7% of their total operating budget that would be funded in this direction. So we're dealing with a combination of funding methods. But I think if I was a voter in Portland, and the question came to me, would I rather face the question, shall I approve $8 million for 3 years, or shall I approve whatever the amount of tax is for 3 years, I would rather know what the rate of tax was going to be. I think it presents a very honest question to the voters. And the voters know that their property values are going up. I think we hear them talking about that from time to time.
They get the notice of assessment generally 3 days before the regular district election day.
But I don't think we can anticipate
totally forever, 20% increases in property valuations in certain districts every year. The thing has got to stabilize some. I suppose it could, and the whole economy could blow up too, but I think we I think we're still over a 10-year period, we're looking at some more stability than we've had in some areas now. And of course, if we don't get it, then we just have to rely on those local people to not levy the tax. And of course, there are some fairly rigid control mechanisms on local officials. The recall, the election's coming up, as they tend to control legislative opinions on occasion. And so there are some control mechanisms at the local level, as well as some fairly complicated local budget law where they do the planning and working out the budget. So the system of checks and balances is quite adequate.
Two things, and they're really not related. One, what I always thought was wrong with the base plus 6% was that you had to levy it or you couldn't hold it.
Right.
Do you know what the, I'm sure you've done enough historical study to know what the rationale of that was, because I understand that for school boards that was a, it did become a controlling kind of a problem. You had to go back for that base. If you let it erode by your own action, and
maybe Richard Lund may want to correct me, but I believe at one time it was the prior year plus six, and then there was a problem in some revenues.
Well,
in some,
it changed 3 years.
Some revenues in some counties and some school districts will vary dramatically from year to year from other sources. Okay, so this highest of the last three plus six allows you not to necessarily levy up to your base authority and lose it if you've got a cyclical revenue pattern from county school funds or forest receipts or something like that come in not necessarily the same amounts each year. But if you go back to 3 years, that allows you not to have that push to levy clear up to the base each year or lose it. In other words, you've got that three-year cycle to go back.
I never really understood why it was written in there at all.
I think
it is a motivation to spend it.
But I think that what they felt was if the at the time the population was growing, property tax was the method for payment of school costs, 1916, and they were in a growth period in the state population-wise, but I think there's always some reluctance that we don't want to accelerate this authority far beyond the need, and so if they don't levy it, then they obviously shouldn't be able to keep the authority. Because if you're increasing in expenditure need at 4% a year and your taxing authority was increasing and compounding at 6% a year, it wouldn't be very long until you'd have this tremendous amount of taxing authority that you really didn't need, and it might be an endangering thing to the people in the particular area.
The other is that I want to ask about whether trending I could approve, speaking of Portland, if we had a rape operation there this year, the west side would die. In that area, the property value to the our side of the river this year has just gone boom, and I think they, if it were, levied at a rate, it would be a great shock. But I generally approve of that instead of the dollar amount. I think it has, largely because I think that's what people think they're paying anyway, is a rate.
Well, Representative Ritchie, I think there's some question as to whether the property in fact did increase in value 20 or 21% in the past year. Chances are pretty good that it didn't, but that it really had increased an amount maybe up to that level that had done so over a couple of years and just wasn't brought up until this year. I think if we get into the utilization of rate for the purposes of taxation, that we may ultimately be forced to look at maybe a little more adequate system at reviewing the manner of determination of property tax value. And I also own West Side property. I happen to be 150 yards out of Multnomah County in Washington County, but I think we've had effectively the same kind of a thing happen over there. And I really don't think that the valuations
tend to necessarily stay with the property, nor do I think there's necessarily any particular consistency in the state. I've owned property in Linn County, I own property in Clatsop County, I own property in Washington County, and I see quite a drastic difference in the relationship of the real market value and the taxable value. In all instances, the tax value is slightly below the market value. But that's my own personal experience, and maybe I'm just lucky, I don't know.
Well, the concept of trending, I think, was to avoid that headache that morning that you found out 6 years ago you were valued at $10,000 and this year you're valued at $26,000.
It's pretty uniform but, everywhere trending now.
I think it is. We've got a county assessor that can address that. But the trending, the comments you made about the West Hills, the impact of that increased assessed valuation is going to be felt anyway because they are going to be assessed a uniform rate throughout that district for that service. They may not recognize it as the levy authority itself is not a rate basis, it's on a dollar basis, but it will. The impact's the same when you get an increase in valuation. Those people that are in the particular code areas that are on-site visited may get a higher increase than the trended areas. And they're going to feel a little more.
That's only because this is the starting point for the levy, though. But had this been the second year, then it would have disproportionately affected into that particular.
Yeah, right.
Do you
have any further questions?
Yeah.
A couple of questions, John. Do you have any figures on personnel costs of school districts for the purpose of getting budgets passed? I know that some school districts actually have hired people whose sole or primary job is to the public relations, arranging the campaign and getting the budget passed. Other districts have individuals who have a different title, but who in fact spend a high percentage of their time at this task. Have you done any work on determining, what the cost is to school districts of having to go to the voters annually and sometimes more than annually?
Oh, I think from time to time we've done estimates on that. I really don't know, what do they say, $60,000 an election in Portland? And it ranges on down. I think there were some substantial cost increases when they changed it to where the school districts no longer managed their own elections here a few years ago. And I assume that the reason for that is an attempt to get a better election result, although I can't see that it's changed the results of the elections any. Frankly, we've had some difficulty in budget analysis. We have a person that's an accountant that's hired to work with budgets, and because of the breakdown of the various categories and the intermingling of the categories, and as a consequence, we submitted a proposal here. I think the committee chairman has it, and you'll probably see it in a few days, dealing with this matter of budget reporting. Very difficult to pick up just exactly what these costs are in school districts. I can't speak for other municipal corporations, although I understand it's quite difficult there, too. They're under basically the same budget law. And we think that the reporting needs to be modified some to correct that. Perhaps Mr. Dudley might have some comments on the same subject.
On the bill proposal?
The question is, I know that we can determine how much it costs Portland to have an election and how much it costs any district. No, those are the real upfront costs. And I'm saying that aren't there a lot of hidden personnel costs involved in having to have an election every year, or more than one election every year?
Okay.
It appears to me like I have some knowledge of the Tiger School District because I've been with them for 12 years, and I know that they don't have any specialists specifically for the purpose, but I also know that the superintendent, who's the highest paid individual in the district, spends an awful high percentage of his time getting budgets passed.
Yeah. The political reality of the situation is that somebody from your district has got to do a fairly good job of communicating to the public, that community, the community, what the budget's about and what's in it. In terms of hiring somebody to get the budget passed, I wouldn't like to say that's happening because it's illegal. But in cases where they have hired outside consultants in specific types of budget situations, some of the cost for direct proponent type literature is funded by voluntary contributions. For instance, I made a contribution to the Salem budget 2 years ago. They had a citizens group that had a campaign committee that raised money for the school budget. The school district itself cannot appropriate and put money into that kind of an effort. The school district can use staff and prepare data that is objective, factual, and does not
seek a yes or no vote. That's an attorney general's guideline as to what can be done. And there is a law against public official electioneering during regular working hours. Now, what those people in the that are employed by the school district do at noon hour or after school is entirely theirs.
There's a fine line. You know that there's a fine line between electioneering and explaining.
That's right. Understand, though, your real cost of budget defeats is not reflected in the cost of the personnel for preparing the budget or the campaign for the budget. I think most of your real loss comes in a bit.